has been a problem. This nationally has been a problem. There have been reports of votes disappearing, memory cards or memory cartridges disappearing, and that it's a weak link in the chain of custody if we don't have good poll workers. Basically, you are entrusted. Like, I know my mother is a judge of elections, gets in her car and drives that packet of results to the county courthouse. And they trust her to do that. And it's a position of trust. We have to make sure we have good people in it. Yes? Yeah, Dan? Yeah, he's asking about absentee and provisionals. But under HAVA, poll workers are required to offer a provisional ballot to any voter whose name does not appear in the district register or poll book. And we don't, now we record that there was a provisional vote cast. We never know the outcome. They go into the county. And I believe this is pretty much standard on a national level. As far as absentees, your mileage may, they're done, it's so different from state to state. For example, my own county, all of Pennsylvania, we have hand-marked, hand-counted paper ballots for our absentees. And a little man comes around and he delivers them during election day, and then when the day's over, we have to go through the district register, make sure they didn't come in and vote, you know, check their signature. Then we open the envelope, take out the secrecy envelope, open that, take out the ballots, shuffle them up, and count them. And usually they're not very many, but this year we had 32. Other states, they send them in by, an off scan or a different method. So it's real wildly different for absentees. Yep, there's someone up here. Okay, the question is about needing to have the archival data. To be a poll worker, you don't need to have any data at all. All you need to do is go to your county board of elections, and they will be delighted if you. Most counties in this country are desperate for poll workers. What I am proposing is that we, as election integrity people, if we get into these positions, we can then, at the end of the day, collect the data, because we will already be there on the ground, and we can collect the data for some of our programs. And there's nothing illegal, or it's public data. You have a right to this data. But we're just there, and it will take 5 minutes to copy it down and call it into the National Election Data Archive database. But the two are two different things. Yes, Bernie. Okay, well, as far as staying and counting, I would stay till 2 days later if I had to, but I'm very dedicated. However, that said, there is something to be said. Now, Pennsylvania and many states have a law that you cannot have shifts. In other words, the person, the group of people that are there when the polls open in the morning have to be there for the duration till the stuff is counted or whatever. And if we were to change that, it would take a statute change under state law. I have been known, I cannot say I never made a mistake. In fact, in this past election, I had a poll watcher sitting next to me. A poll watcher, of course, is a person who is observing for a party or a candidate. And I said, well, you watch me because I'm really tired. And sure enough, I flipped two digits. I wrote 23 instead of 32 on something. It was not intentional. I was just exhausted. And, you know, fortunately, they caught it. So it's a two-sided coin. It's a wonderful thing, and I support having the audits, but having the same tired people conduct them might open the door to mistakes, honest mistakes. I support being, in fact, Pennsylvania has a law where they will choose the precincts to be audited in you know, like right after election night. They will use the data or the announced figures from the machines on election night. Then within 48 hours, they will choose the precincts by drawing. They have to actually draw them out of a hopper of some kind. And then they will proceed to the audit within 48 hours after that. So it would be a maximum of like 4 days. That would give people say, well, that opens the door for people to do fraud. Yeah, it could, but at least you would have people that are not exhausted doing the count, especially if you mandate that it be the original people that were there on election day. Again, there are pros and cons of everything. I personally think if they use the data or use the announced totals from the machines on election night, somebody can't go in and change the machines, and it will be a lot harder to go in and monkey with the papers. So I think that it would probably be okay to do it that way. Anybody else? Oh, in the okay, my home state of Pennsylvania just had a law proposed, as many states do. And our law, the way it's proposed, says that on election night, they will get a total from the voting machines. That total is publicly announced. It's posted on the door of every precinct. We are very, very good about that in our state. And then they will, the next day or within 48 hours, choose the precincts that are going to be the random audit precincts. And it has to be a true random choice. Then, within 48 hours after that, they have to proceed to a hand count of the voter-verified paper records in those chosen. Then they will compare that total with the election night total. So that's... She's asking about the chain of evidence and who signed. There is so much signing when you are a poll worker, and swearing. Sometimes there's swearing that you don't want to do. It's not legal swearing, but there is more. You take more oaths on election day than you'll probably take in your entire life. You have to sign and give an oath in the morning that you're going to be honest. You have to sign when you do the zero tape or zero on the machines that it truly said zero, and you have to swear to that. You have to swear if somebody comes in and votes and the machine's stuck and you have to have an extra vote on the machine, you know, say we had 150 people sign the poll book and there's 151 votes. I have to sign my life away why there's that extra vote on the machine because it's stuck. There is so much signing. And yes, now this is my state. It could vary from state to state. And it's my understanding that in some states they really do have very lax chain of custody. You know, I give it to you, you give it to her, you know. It might get to the courthouse sometime. Yeah, this is why we need people of integrity in these positions, so that we can help make sure that it's done right and also work for changes in the law. If poll workers would become more proactive and not be the little old ladies with their hair in a bun, one of the things that I'm proposing is, and I'm actually working to start, is a National Poll Worker Association. And hopefully my speech here at this conference will sort of be a nucleus of that. There is no national organization for poll workers, and we could have a set of ethics that we follow, and also sort of encourage each other to do things like watch what our laws are, watch how the chain of custody is being handled, and so forth. Yeah, I think we have time for one more. When I say machine, it could be any type of machine. In my own case, my county is still on lever machines. So we have to open up the back and look at all the old odometers and count the odometers. But the basic process is the same whether it's a DRE or a lever machine or OpScan or whatever. Even hand-counted paper ballots, there's still this same basic process that you have to do, to do the election. So I don't want to cut into anyone else's time, so thank you all. Get out there and become a poll worker, please.
You think it's going to work? Do I get the remote? Do I get to hear? I don't need it. I can do this without the picture back up. Okay. God, that sounds loud. Well, hello, everyone. My name is Radiananda, and I've lived most of my life in Ohio, although my first memories are from Portland. I lived here till I was three, so I remember the trees and all that. And my family's lived here for generations, and I'm delighted to be back in the Pacific Northwest. Hello, Oregon! I speak for dozens of CORE people in Ohio, but I became actively committed just last year. November 2004 changed my life. Although I did pay attention when the U.S. Supreme Court awarded the presidency to Mr. Bush, I was in school at the time and I had to finish my education, so I got involved after graduating in 2004 and worked on the Kerry campaign. I now recognize this fight for election fairness has been going on, well, actually for decades, but certainly since 2000. And I'm sorry I didn't join you earlier. Sometime this year it occurred to me that, remember that a terrorist attack they said was going to happen to our computers on the millennium? I think that we did get the terrorist attacked, but it wasn't a crash of our financial and health data. It was the theft of our democracy through the use of computers. That's how I see it today. When Kerry conceded in 2004 without calling for a recount in Ohio, I was stunned and confused. And I have watched him share a stage with Bruce Springsteen not a month before, promising to count every vote. So when they did it again in 2004, when the Ohio Supreme Court, held up the recount so that the electors were seated before the recount was completed, I panicked, and I perceive and still perceive that this country had been taken over, and I started working even harder for democracy, and all of us in Ohio did. I have voted in every presidential election since 1976, and I've always been proud and excited. Although as I got older, I was more secretive about that, about being able to vote. I never lost that excitement until when I saw, I have been in Republican bedroom community precincts and working class Democratic precincts and voted. And I know what a Democratic win in Ohio looks like. In November of 2004, I served for the DNC as a numbers runner. I went to four different precincts that day twice during the day to get their numbers, and I saw the lines. One of those precincts was Republican, so I know what a Democrat win in Ohio looks like, even though it was reported opposite. When they called the election at 1 or 2 in the morning on November 3rd, I just said no. So, and I am personally impacted by what happened as well, spiritually, morally, financially. They voted all that anti-gay legislation, especially in Ohio, which to me is legitimizing me as a second-class citizen, contrary to the principles of democracy. So with 3 months' education, political education, what I got off the net, I started calling for election reform meetings in Ohio, because we did have a group of people got together on January 30th, and then nothing was happening, so I started writing to them, those people who had showed up at that meeting. And we didn't really get that really going for another three months. And so I just jumped on the internet and started listing election reform meetings in Columbus, and people started showing up. With my 3 months of political education, I've made many mistakes. but most of us have. Most of us involved in Ohio are pretty much brand new to political activism. I have to say that many of the leaders in the voter rights movement are here today, and I welcome and salute them. And especially those who have been working on this for 2000 and prior, I think they are the real visionaries of our movement, and I'm grateful to all of them. I saw a movie the other night. Billy Bob Thornton was a bank robber, a neurotic genius, and he found himself surrounded by the police, and he blamed his partner, Bruce Willis, and in Billy Bob Thornton's particular accent said, "You know what the problem with being smart is? You know what's going to happen." And that's the real visionaries of our movement, are those who see what's coming long before the rest of us do. So I'm speaking as what they call a netrooter. They have a new name for us now, netroots, online activists. I'm not a specialist. I didn't devise or suggest most of what Ohio's done, but I've helped along with, at one point, 100 other people. And I've been keeping track of what Ohio's been doing, and I've been writing about it, and some of it's been published on the web. And I just follow what I learn on the net. I want to say that the slogans that activated me were, be the media, be your own leader, envision a brighter future, create the reality you want, be the change you want to see, and we're the leaders we've been waiting for. So I drove my friends and strangers who were foolish enough to give me their email nuts with my political email newsletters I started sending out. And I'm convinced that this skirmish that started in 2000 is not going away. That the movement is here, it's upon us, and the dedicated core of people who keep showing up at these conferences, we're not going away. We're going to get our democracy back. Okay. So this is what we've done in Ohio as citizens. Let me say, I've laid out a bunch of material down here. You're welcome to take copies. I did not make enough copies. So maybe you can look at it, or if you want, you can write me and I can email you a copy if we're out. Most of the spectacular work that has been done in Ohio was carried out by professionals, attorneys, statisticians, computer scientists, professional journalists, and professional investigators. We've had honest Board of Election, BOE, members step forward and have lost their job for speaking the truth about things that happened in Ohio. We've had, of course, national radio DJs promoting what happened in Ohio and still talking about what happened in Ohio. And we've had a couple of brave and patriotic representatives and the one sole senator who finally stood up and noted their objections. That was historical. That was so historical. It only happened once before in U.S. history. And how much media play did it get? This is amazing. So Ohioans and all those aware of our crippled and dying democracy are ever grateful for the leadership of those professionals who really have led the way. Citizens have also stepped into the march and within and without Ohio, helping Ohioans. And so these are the steps we took and the ones we foresee. And my thinking, my suggestion, my reason for even wanting to talk in front of anybody, being such a newbie to the movement, is that so much work has been done in Ohio that maybe you can take lead from what we've done and mold it for your area, tailor it to your own movement. Because what we need to do, inevitably, is draw in more and more citizens, because democracy means self-governance. So democracy is something you do. If you give, I just read this great quote, if you give 10 minutes a year to democracy, voting in a booth, that's all the democracy you're going to get. And then the converse to that, of course, is what's the least you can do and commit to doing it every week? If you can give 5 minutes a week, 10 minutes a week to democracy, then just commit to doing it. All right, so here's our list. Big media press releases. And we've had so much great press, I think, even if it's some of it's alternative press. So many wonderfully written articles. And I put together a stack of the most recent batch of excellent articles on election fraud down there. Like I said, national and local radio coverage. Bob Fitrakis published the Essential Documents Handbook, which I think is for sale here. It's the size of a telephone book, and it categorizes the fraud that and malfeasance that occurred in Ohio, if you want the evidence that Ohio's election was stolen. We've had 3 teach-ins so far. Or 4, and And we have blogs, of course. We've written songs. There's a CD on the net. If you go to www.maddogmusic.com, we've got a CD called Ohio in the Dark. And we have all kinds of rallies. We have rallies all the time. And our musicians come out and play these songs. Street theater, we've allied with the Backbone Campaign, and one of their tenets of having a backbone in a democracy is that you have fair elections. So we've allied with them. We've done a lot of backbone actions in front of our media. We've had prayer, drum, and energy circles. I mean, we're doing everything we can to get our country back. We develop talking points, and we're continually rewriting them and publishing them on our listservs, J30 and CASE and Ohio Vigilance. Those are the three main groups in Ohio that are working on election reform. Marketing and blending. I think that you have to sell election reform, which is a terrible... You have to sell fair elections like you would sell any product, and I think we need to get better at this, at marketing it. Blending is when you piggyback with someone else's, like a fair wage. Minimum wage is not livable. Minimum wage, I think we can all agree, is slave wages. And so you can show up at a labor rally and say, you know, fair elections too. You can just blend their message with ours. In fact, a good thing on marketing and blending. I just want to, whenever we have a teach-in, what we've done is we just bring a lot of our materials, our favorite articles, or we create these information packets with really colorful graphics. The other day, I went to an ACLU meeting that was speaking. They brought in a technology expert speaking about the Patriot Act, and of course. Some people, not me, and not even anybody I knew, asked him questions about technology of voting on these computers, and he was just adamant. Well, the short answer to your question is no. They're not. Your vote is not safe on computers. I could give you a half-hour lecture, but I'm here to talk about the page. I mean, which was excellent. So that's a way of blending. When I showed up at this ACLU meeting, they had their packet. Their packets are slick. They have well-written. There's another packet down there too. These informational booklets, and then they've got all these wonderful bumper stickers or window stickers. I put some down there. Please feel free to take them. I'd like to see us do a little bit more of that. We need funding, of course, and I'll leave that up to the financial experts in our movement to figure out. But we don't have any. Yeah, there must be somebody who graduated with an MBA. In this movement. Handbook for Activists. This is something that that I actually created. We needed to be talking to our BOEs, and this might be boring right now, but it could be helpful to you in your regions. What I did was I went through... Here we go. This is posted on the web, and it'll also be in the... It's in the Essential Documents book. I listed every county... How they voted, the numbers by which they supposedly voted, what kind of machine they used, what kind of voting technology they used, how much it cost, and I've listed the voting problems that made it to my awareness for every county in Ohio, and this is really a handy kind piece of information for any activist in your state if you have it tailored for your state. Because before you call a BOE to talk to them, you've got the information right in front of you. We've done some mild recruitment and training, but I think we need a whole lot more of that. Especially as a pretty much a neophyte politically. That, you know, I didn't even know who was who in Ohio. I don't know who the chair of the Democratic Party is or any of that. And all of that I had to learn on the fly. And so, speaking as a grassroots activist, I would sure love to have our leaders develop some kind of training program for new recruits. And I see this as something that would be which would be useful in any region in the country. And fundraising, funding, MBA. I think we need to develop, and we are this weekend, we're working on developing a vision statement that the whole movement can agree on. And then finally, if not least, probably the most important thing I think we can do and have started doing in Ohio, I'm happy to report, is parallel elections. I mean, absolutely. We conduct our own canvas of the vote outside a precinct, and have people voluntarily come up and tell us how they voted, sign their name to it like it's an affidavit, and that way we can keep track. I'll tell you something interesting. There, Judy Alter will be giving a workshop on parallel elections. It's just something interesting that happened in Ohio. A Democrat in a special election on August 2nd in Ohio ran in a heavy, heavy Republican, traditionally, historically Republican area of Ohio against a right... he's an Iraq war vet who's against the war. I mean, this is his platform. Against a right-wing, female, religious, ultra-religious candidate. She won. But the interesting thing is the one precinct where parallel election was held, there were something like, the numbers are really close here, don't quote me, 200 people registered in that precinct, 8 registered Democrats. Paul Hackett took 60% of the votes. Is that right, Marge? Okay. Yeah. Now that's interesting because that's the only place where we were auditing the election. I just think it's interesting. Okay. Did they? A Democrat, a male, ran in a strongly Republican area, district, which has historically always voted Republican, and in the one precinct where citizens actually conducted a parallel election, he overwhelmingly took that precinct. Okay, I guess I'd... To me, that means that the rest of the election is questionable that she won. That's what it means to me. Because the only place where we actually audited what the officials were doing, he won. That's what it means to me. Any other... Am I getting... The questions go only up to 2 o'clock for me? Okay. All right, then I'll give you my closing paragraph, if that's okay. This has been one hell of a roller coaster ride for me emotionally the past 11 months, and it's taken pretty much every aspect of my nature to stay focused on a vision that I can live with in this country. My learning curve has been vertical, pretty much still. I've made many mistakes and had much education. People pull me aside and say, no, really, you know, because I'm a newbie. And that's true for many activists that I'm working with. But so far they haven't kicked me out, thanks. I've had to recreate my life to accommodate this passion I now feel for democracy, which I just didn't have before, frankly. This dream, this fairy tale they taught me that we live in. It's pretty hard to take your blinders off and realize that your country has been taken over by big money corporate interests, and they've had at least 40 years to plan and implement their vision of a world dominion. And I've learned that elections have always been defrauded. But where one person was once able to steal a few hundred votes, stuff a few hundred votes, grab 5 drunks and drive them around to 20 precincts, you know, in a 12-hour voting day. Today, one programmer can tweak all the votes. So we can co-create a future that benefits the majority of us, or we can acquiesce, cooperate with the future envisioned by those who steal our vote, or those who would steal our vote, and which benefits just a few of us. I'd like to close with a Lynn Landis quote. There are some civic duties for which your presence is required, and voting is one of them. So thanks for showing up. Okay. Are there any questions? Bernie. I know that he has finished it and turned it over to his superiors, who I don't know who they are, and that they're holding it back. Yeah.
Well, some of us are hoping they're holding it back because it has evidence about the court of law. But the second point of the question, with regard to Hackett's list, those of us following it saw lots of
you're asking the neophyte. I don't know. Joanne Karasak is heading up that. And I just got an email the other day that Paul Hackett is running something in Ohio. Okay. Yeah. Please. You must be a reporter. I believe that elections and what do you mean by election reform? She said, what do you mean by election reform? And I actually don't like that term. I think that elections in a democracy need to reflect the will of the voters. I don't believe elections in this country reflect the will of the voters. Yes. In fact, you can take. There are 100 anomalies that happened in Ohio, from vote switching to absolute. Voters received notice that if they showed up, they would be arrested. Machines were withheld, so we had long lines in predominantly African American Democratic precincts. We had, the votes were added to Bush. These are the things we caught. 4,200 votes were added to Bush, or 4,200 votes were recorded in a count in a precinct that only had 600 voters. 25 million was subtracted from Kerry in one precinct. Two precincts had over 98% turnout when the record for the state was around 70. We're promoting a completely parallel election system. I just can't believe we go along with that. institution of voting in Ohio is so corrupted. We just, the Franklin County Democratic, or the Franklin County Board of Elections director was charged with accepting a $10,000 bribe and forwarding a $50,000 bribe. And you know what happened? He got charged $12,000. He didn't go to jail. He circumvented democracy and he didn't go to jail. And the Democratic Party chairman stood up and defended him in the media. That institution to me is so corrupted we can't even touch it anymore. And I don't care if it's Republican, Democrat, Independent, Green, or whatever. I want my vote to count. So... Please. Yeah. It's shocking to me. I agree. Thank you. Okay.
Is that what this is hot. Maybe we could pass this around.
Yeah. Here. Why don't you go ahead and take it?
Test.
Yeah, this is working.
Okay, in doing some of the parallel elections in Southern California, it seems to me a very easy thing, and I'm sure I'm wrong, and maybe someone will be able to tell me why, is why can't we, if we have the paper ballots counting with the machine, why there can't be just some volunteers from the precinct just to count by hand that very night. We pay an ungodly amount of money for a small percent recount. And just with a few people doing it, it would be very easy. Is that clear, the question?
I think it goes to, it's more of a legal question, though. The way the laws are set up in Ohio, we can't do that inside the precinct. They have it set up. I mean, the playing field isn't level. It's a great suggestion, but at this point I'm so tired of trying to work within the system and watching what the system is doing that I have to go with this idea of parallel institutions, parallel banking, parallel economy,
parallel justice,
parallel energy sources. I mean, parallel elections. Thank you. Here.
I would like to see the reform that we have a paper ballot that has capability for independent recount capability and audit capability.
Mm-hmm.
The computers, we've seen the software is extremely faulty. As Bev Harris will point out, that their computer experts have studied. It's set up, unfortunately, for treason, for fraud. And I hope she will explain all of that when she speaks. But we need a paper ballot. It's the only way to guarantee at least the possibility of a recount and audit capability if there's question. The computers are, unfortunately, designed to manipulate numbers. They're not adding machines at this point.
Thank you. I agree. All right, everyone. I think we're good. Thanks. There you go.
The next speaker said we're behind schedule at 9:57.
Okay, this is the... National Summit to Save Our Elections, coming from Portland, Oregon, at the First Unitarian Church. What we just heard was the poll worker from Mary Beth Kuznick. Then I think democracy is something you do. And a Working Families Party in Oregon. I don't know why those things are in parentheses, but they are. No, that would be democracy is something you do with Randy Ananda. They're taking a short break now. At 2:15 Pacific time, that would be 5:15 Eastern, we'll begin a... I don't know what you call it, a panel. It'll be Beyond Voting, Learning to Confront Corporate Rule. And that will be with David Cobb and Dan Meek. David Cobb, of course, was the Green Party candidate for president in 2004. And I don't know who Dan Meek is. I'm not prepared for this. In any case, we will allow you to listen to people talking. The hubbub. There are about maybe 30 people here. What's going to be happening the rest of the day? We'll be listening to Electoral Systems 101, and that will be at 6:30 Eastern, 3:30 here. In fact, Dan Meek just walked by. The presenter for that will be Steve Chesson. I think a lot of these... Pokey was here, but she's now... Pokey Anderson is here. Pokey Anderson does Sunday Monitor in Houston on KPFT. And that is at normally 7 Eastern, 6 Central. And she probably knows who all these people are because she's an expert on the whole election process. And then, well, here she is. Who's? Don't talk to me for a second. I need another chair here. I'll get you another mic. I mean, you might as well talk. People are going to start listening. So, who is? We know who David Cobb is. Who's Dan Meek?
Don't know Dan Meek.
Ah, okay. So Pokey doesn't know Dan Meek.
There's quite a few names here that I'm not so familiar with.
Yeah, actually, I think we can get it. They probably have it up front. I can go grab it. Or is it on your handout?
Hey, let's see. Dan Meek's going to cover the Oregon Campaign Finance Reform Initiative. They're trying to, using the model that's already been set up in Arizona, and I believe it's Maine, they're going to try to do some campaign reform. So I think that means public financing of elections.
And I noticed there's one on IRV and PR. I'm not sure. What is PR?
Not sure.
Those are voting methods.
Yeah.
IRV is instant runoff voting.
Right.
And I'm not sure what PR is.
Not sure. It must be related to the whole idea of having multiple candidates and, you know, getting several elected at one time. Thereby, the idea is to have more a representation of people who may not constitute a majority.
That's an interesting idea. You mean we wouldn't be doing winner-take-all?
Right.
The Federalist Papers live, is that what you're saying? The tyranny of the majority would be passed over?
Well, you know, the tyranny of the majority really was not written into the Constitution. There was quite a bit of minority finagling going on.
Right. Well, yeah, the whole James Madison and the Federalist Papers were all about that. At least that was one of the things those were one of the issues that they were afraid of, that suddenly whole points of view would be lost.
Right, and so they let the small states and the southern states boss them around a little bit, even at the outset.
Today, it's still going on.
It's still going on, yes.
Except some of them are being indicted.
some of the small states?
No, the large state, the large state that we come from. our majority leader in the Congress has now been indicted after 6 grand juries or something.
Yeah. There's a call for, by some, of course, not Republicans, that he should actually be kicked out of Congress for his various transgressions, including, 3 ethics committee findings of transgressions, the golf trips to Scotland paid for by lobbyists, his association with Jack Abramoff. It goes on and on and on. But the man raises $1 jillion a day for his puppies, who then join up and vote exactly how he says in Congress. So he does have power, and he will continue to have power until somebody takes it away.
We're sitting here in the sanctuary at the First Unitarian Church in Portland, Oregon. And I think we're broadcasting to one person.
Well, that word's getting ready to get out. If you are that one person, if you would tell a couple other people, that would be great.
Yeah, that's Sirius. That's John Sirius in New York.
Oh.
But it will heat up. And then at this evening is when the big plenary is. Who is it? Darlene Hooley from the 5th District in Oregon. Do you know her?
No, I guess that's kind of our... Oh, Congresswoman Darlene Hooley.
Yes.
That must be our official welcoming person.
Yeah, and then what are we doing then?
Then we have... Go ahead. What's wrong with electronic elections, and what can we do about it? The moderator will be Brad Friedman of Brad Blog, and the panelists will be Paul Leto of Washington State, Ellen Tyson, Voters Unite, and Clint Curtis, who Brad certainly knows a fair amount about.
Clint Curtis, yeah.
Yes, a programmer who has an interesting story about being told to design some electronic voting equipment that could steal an election.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah, and the person who he says asked him to do it, or knew that he was being asked, is a current congressperson in Florida. Yeah. So, and then following that, Brad Friedman and Bob Kohler of the Chicago Tribune will be talking about the media. The title is "The Media Stumbling Block: Bypassing a Complacent Media to Sound the Alarm on Elections in Crisis." So that'll be tonight, starting around 6:30 until 9 o'clock, and that's Pacific time.
So that would be 9:30 to midnight Eastern. I think there's a story about Bob Kohler's columns. There's some columns that he wrote that. Do you know that story?
Yeah, he's been a newspaper man for many, many years, and his columns are syndicated.
Well, I think we're...
Oh, are we going?
No, I'm not sure.
I typically move a bit, but if you need me to be stationary, let me know, and I will.
What we're doing?
Sometimes I know that you don't.
They did have a wireless mic there, but I don't see it.
Agreed at 3:15, which is your break, to continue the debate downstairs. I would highly encourage you to do it. Fusion voting versus...
Instant runoff voting.
Very interesting stuff.
And you want a dialogue, not a debate, because Barbara Dudley and David Cobb are... We do politics differently, you know. But it was definitely a difference of opinion. So,
I think we've started.
This is David Cobb, the 2004 presidential candidate for the Greens. He's formerly a Texan, an attorney.
Will I be okay on this? Give you a mic check. All right. Thank you for coming. My name is David Cobb.
Thanks,
I was
Pokey.
The Green Party's candidate for president of the United States.
Starting
Thank
again.
You. And before my time starts, Mr. Timekeeper, I just want to say, I'll say it again later, and I'll say it all through this weekend, George W. Bush was not elected president in either 2000 or 2004.
And shame on Al Gore and John Kerry for not fighting to secure the elections that they probably won. However, what we're about here today is about corporate constitutional rights and how it is that unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are not merely exercising power over us, they are ruling us. As surely as kings rule their subject, as surely as masters rule their slaves, the reality is that unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs have hijacked our government, our institutions, and our culture, and they are literally making the fundamental public policy decisions that affect our lives. They are actually governing us. And it's time to start telling that truth, because I am going to tell the truth as I see it. And in order to do this, what we're going to do is literally in 10 to 15 minutes, I'm going to provide an opening framework for corporate personhood or corporate constitutional rights, basically try to outline how the U.S. constitutional framework works or is supposed to. Then we're going to have Dan Meeks from Oregon, an Oregon attorney and a longtime fighter for truth, justice, and democracy in this state, to describe what Oregonians are doing at the state level. And then I'll come back for about 5 minutes talking about a specific local campaign that we're doing where I live, Humboldt County, California, that we're trying to convince other folks to replicate. So that's the framework for this. And then we're going to open it up for discussion, because both Dan and I are committed to actually engaging in some dialogue about this. So here's my attempt to give you a crash course in U.S. constitutional theory. The U.S. Constitution, how many people here have read the Constitution recently? Man, this is a different crowd, right? See if I basically get this right. The U.S. Constitution basically is comprised of a very profound dichotomy. In the U.S. Constitution, it describes we the people, and it describes government. Let's stop for a moment and acknowledge that the word corporation is not in the Constitution, nowhere to be found. Might suggest to us, that especially for those people who claim to be strict constructionists, that perhaps the Founding Fathers did not expect the corporation to play any meaningful role in the body politic. So, in the U.S. Constitution, we the people are described as free and sovereign. I like that so far. Government is described as subordinate and accountable. Yeah, I hold the chuckles. This is the way it's supposed to work. Subordinate and accountable. Accountable to whom? To the people. Why? Because under this constitutional framework, all legitimate power is actually held by the people. And only that power that is delegated to government does government have. And in fact, why is the power delegated? In order for government to do those specific things that we want them to be held accountable for. We the people in the U.S. Constitution are described as holding individual rights. Government is described as having collective duties. The people have rights that are sacrosanct. Government has duties. Duties to whom? The people. The legitimate power that has been delegated is only delegated in order for them to implement or execute the duties that they have, and that we, the people, are supposed to hold them subordinate and accountable. And I look at that and I say, folks, this is brilliant. This is genius. Do you know why? Because it captures individuality and how sacrosanct a human being is as a sovereign person, right? And it understands that when you begin to act, that's in your private sphere, when you begin to act in the public sphere, that you're entering into community. So it understands both civil liberties and communitarian ethos. It understands that, and they're pretty important and powerful stuff to understand, that the people are sacrosanct. They are hallowed words, right? And I look at that and I say, it's genius, and I say, we should try that in this country. I think it might work. I think representative democracy would actually work. And I'm totally serious, because not only is it kind of a cheap chuckle in a crowd like this, but in addition to that, I have to say we have never actually implemented this framework in this country. Because a quick pop quiz, U.S. Constitution, you can either tell me when it was being discussed in Philadelphia or when it was ratified, but what's the year or years? 1787 to 1789, that begins the ratification process. A very sharp crew here. So we got 1787 to 1789. Now, in 1787 to 1789, somebody now tell me, who are the people? White? Hold on. White. Landowners or property owners? Male. In many states, by the way, they had to be of the right religion. And slave owners. So what we have... I'm sorry, say it. Who got extra? They got extra representation based on the holding of slaves. So what I'm telling you is, as beautiful as this framework is, it is founded and comes out of a racist and sexist and class oppressive reality. You're welcome. It's the truth. We got to do some truth telling here, right? So, for all these beautiful words, how many human beings, adults, let's not even get into the children that don't actually get to be part of this, how many of the adults living in the area that we now describe as the 13 original colonies, which were nations before Europeans ever got here, how many of the human beings were actually people with those vested, vaunted, sacrosanct rights? Anybody know? Linda, say it. 10% of the human beings here were actually people. So before we, and you allow me to wax eloquent about how tearjerker it is for the founding of this country, let's just understand that there was a founding violence against women and people of color, indigenous slaves who were brought to this country. This was a myth. It was not working because only 10% of the human beings here could actually claim those rights. Now, some might say, in fact, I would suggest to you that the entire history of the United States from one lens can really be understood as a series of struggles by different people, movements, to drive themselves into the Constitution, to force the legal system to recognize them as people. And let's honor that, right? And by the way, nobody gave women the right to vote. They organized and agitated and got it for themselves. Right? Every single movement that I'm talking about here is not a function of those up on high, the leaders deciding to grant us any damn thing. It's because of agitation, education, and organization movements that drive it. So others might say, okay, Cobb, I'll give you that. But chill out, man. Now, every human being in this country is a person with... This applies to everybody now, right? And I say, no. Because even though we've had those struggles that I honor and acknowledge and am grateful for, the women's rights movement, the civil rights movement, the most recent civil rights movement, the abolitionist movement, the trade union movement, I mean, all of these movements that had to actually challenge the culture and existing law, right? But the reality is something else happened in the courts undermining this entire notion. Because now, and isn't it interesting, I said we were going to talk about corporate rule, and so far I've spent all my time talking about the Constitution and the democratic underpinnings. Here's how corporations come in. Under law, by the way, a corporation is created by state government when they issue a charter. That charter can, and at one time did, very strictly control the duties, held the corporation very accountable, and was subordinate to the state legislature and to the people's representatives. Point I'm making is, properly understood, and if it's true that this dichotomy is so important, if I'm right about that, and I am, if this is so important, then a corporation must properly be understood to be on this side of the line. A corporation is a creature of the state, right? And the state government can and should, and at one time did, tightly control everything that it could do. Did you know that under every state law in the country, there were absolute prohibitions against corporations making political contributions? There were restrictions on corporations owning any land other than the direct land that they needed to exist. They were only allowed to exist typically 10 to 15 years, at which point they were automatically dissolved and then had to go back and ask for a new charter all over again. And check this out. To get that charter, it had to go through the state legislature, and if it was a bicameral state legislature, which most were, it had to literally go through the state House of Representatives, the state Senate, go to the governor and get signed. Every step of the way, they had to be arguing and proving that what they were doing was in the public interest. And if they were ever found not to be in the public interest, their charter was revoked, and they were literally disbanded. Now, that's the people who understood the proper role of a corporation. Right? And that is our legacy. That is our historical birthright for understanding the role, the proper role of a corporation today. But in 1886, the U.S. Supreme Court, and subsequent cases, I won't go into the details of it, but let's just say that the U.S. Supreme Court said, oh no, really corporations are nothing more than a grouping of individuals. They're individual shareholders. They pool their property. Therefore, when they pool their property, that property now all of a sudden is a person vested with rights. So corporate personhood is the ability for a corporation to claim that they have rights and then can go into court and overturn democratically enacted laws at the local, state, or even federal level attempting to control their conduct. Folks, corporations claiming to be constitutional rights or corporate personhood perverts the entire framework of democracy. It makes democracy and economic democracy impossible. So what I'm saying is, I want to be a part of a movement that is going to delegitimize this legal doctrine. Not merely to change a law or two. Laws need to be changed, right? No doubt about it. But let's be clear. The abolitionists were not calling for a Slavery Protection Act. Right? They went head on against a depraved institution. Today, I'm not asking for more socially responsible corporations. I'm calling for a movement for real democracy where the people have the authority, the legal right, and the moral responsibility to create our own government. That's what we're talking about here. That's why corporate personhood, I believe, is the linchpin for the legal doctrine, because as a lawyer, let me just conclude with this observation. Corporations are destroying the planet. They are literally destroying the earth, the life support system upon which we all depend and upon which we are all part of. And they are creating a racist, sexist, and class oppressive world order with the plunder of the rape of Mother Earth. And to add insult to injury, they masquerade as if this whole process is democracy, when in point of fact, it is at best plutocracy or kleptocracy. Right? So what I'm getting at is this, is we're talking about the framework I've tried to raise is a understanding that I don't want to be part of a movement that just tinkers at the edges. I want to be part of a movement for genuine democracy, and that when we go about our work on the ground, like Dan is about to describe, what I'll about to describe later, let's keep this in mind and remember that if we do our job well as organizers and as social change agents, we really should be delegitimizing this legal doctrine. The same way the abolitionists understood that that was their job, the same way that the women's suffrage movement understood, the same way that the trade union movement did, the same way the civil rights movement did. At the end of the day, that's, I think, what we're about. If we're about a national summit to save our democracy, it's not merely about machines counting or casting ballots. It's about who's in charge, who has the authority, and it's we the people. Thank you.
Thank you.
How'd I do on time?
I hate to tap this. Does this work? Yes, it does. Maybe we can call it Texocracy, since all of our presidents now seem to come from Texas. I'd like to thank David for for bringing from Texas the warm, wet weather that we have today. It's probably rained more today than it has in the entire summer, for those of you who aren't from Oregon. How many people are from Oregon here? Quite a, no, live here. Okay. Quite a few. Well, in reading the newspaper today, it seemed to me that the $140,000 question is, who is smarter, Ken Lay or Tom DeLay? And let me give a description, then you can decide. Ken Lay, in 1997, moved his corporation, legally, Enron, to Oregon. As David mentioned, corporations are chartered by states, and many U.S. corporations are chartered in Delaware because that's been the most lenient state when it comes to controlling their function and operation. Enron was a Delaware corporation, but after Ken Lay came up to Oregon in 1996 and 1997 and checked out the proceedings up here, he dissolved Enron as a Delaware corporation and reincorporated it in Oregon. Enron, to this day, the big worldwide Enron bankrupt corporation, is an Oregon chartered corporation. Enron in 1997 bought Portland General Electric, our largest investor-owned utility here, and brought us all sorts of benefits. It brought us the largest rate increase, electric utility rate increase in Oregon history, a $400 million annual increase in 2001. And since 1997 has charged us, the ratepayers, over $800 million for state income taxes and federal income taxes that it has never paid and never will pay. Went down to the Oregon Public Utility Commission, our supposed watchdog, and said, well, you know, we want about $200 million in profits every year from Oregon ratepayers. And PUC said, okay. And Enron said, well, but, you know, we need actually more than that because we want ratepayers to pay our income taxes also. So the $200 million would be net of income taxes. We'll add $93 million a year to rates so that ratepayers are paying your income taxes. Well, then it turns out that neither Enron nor Portland General Electric ever paid those income taxes at all. Well, sometimes I say that and people say, well, you're wrong, Dan. In fact, PGE did pay some income taxes. That's right. In the year 2002, PGE did pay some Oregon state income taxes. It paid $10. So, and it paid $700,000 in federal income taxes that year as well. So, charged us $800 million for income taxes. It paid less than 1% and kept 99.9% for itself. Enron then also destroyed the 401k pension plans of PGE employees by stuffing the pension plans with Enron stock, which then became worthless. Of course, the executives went home with hundreds of millions of dollars. Ken Lay himself went home with several hundred million dollars. So, let's compare him to Tom DeLay. Tom DeLay is alleged to have conspired to arrange for corporate contributions, about $140,000, to the Republican National Committee to be laundered back to candidates for the Texas legislature. And he's been indicted for that because that's a crime in Texas. Well, what if Tom DeLay had been like his buddy Ken Lay and instead had moved to Oregon? In Oregon, it's not a crime. It's perfectly legal. It happens all the time. So who's smarter, Tom DeLay or Ken Lay? Ken Lay made the move to Oregon, stole hundreds of millions of dollars for himself and his friends. And in Oregon, it's all perfectly legal. Because Oregon is one of only five states in the United States with no limits on campaign contributions. Corporations can contribute as much as they want in Oregon. There's only four other states: New Mexico, Illinois, Utah, and Virginia. In 1996, when Enron came to Oregon, the total amount spent on candidate races was $4.2 million. In 2002, which is the last year for which data is available, the amount was $42 million. It increased by a factor of 10 since Enron came to Oregon. Of course, PGE only contributed about half a million dollars of that. As a result, corporations in Oregon outspend labor in political races by 5-1, and they outspend everyone else by hundreds to one. Individuals can also give an unlimited amount. Lauren Parks, in the last election for governor, contributed over $600,000 himself to the campaign, to Kevin Mannix's campaign. Rod and Rich Went of timber company fame gave $250,000 to Mannix. Joan Austin, who was the president of a medical equipment company in Newburgh gave $200,000 of her personal money to the campaign. The 2002 race for governor was, of course, the most expensive governor's race in Oregon history. $15 million was spent. The candidates in the general election spent $4 million each. In the primary, in order to be taken seriously, you had to raise and spend at least $1.5 million. The result of spending this money in Oregon is buying elections. Even if the votes are counted correctly in Oregon, money buys the votes. For the Oregon legislature in the last two elections, 91% of the races were won by the candidate who spent the most money. In the Oregon Senate, that means 27 out of the 30 races were won by the biggest spender. But of the three that weren't run by the biggest spender, all of them were former legislators who then had name recognition, and each of them spent an average of $200,000 anyway. They were barely outspent. So the principle remains that if you spend more money in an Oregon race, you are almost certain to win it. Right now, an Oregon Senate race costs, if it's contested, about $500,000 per candidate, and that means that we're talking about spending something on the order of $15 a vote. In the House races, are now going for about $200,000 to $250,000, so people are spending again between $10 and $15 per vote in House races in Oregon. In Oregon, only 2% of the money going to politicians comes from those contributing $50 or less. Unless you contribute more than $50 to a candidate, 98% of the money is coming from the folks who contribute more. In 2002, in the legislative races, 70% of all of the money contributed to the races came from fewer than 1,200 people, and their contributions averaged $6,700 each. So you can wipe out, basically, you can wipe out 30%. If you just rely on 1,200 people in Oregon, that is by far the majority of the political contributions that were made in legislative races. What does this buy in Oregon for the corporations? The first thing it buys is a generically terrible tax system. A 2004 study by the Council on State Taxation found that Oregon ranks last among states in business taxes per dollar of economic activity. And we'll find out a little bit later that that money instead comes from individuals and comes from the fact that Oregon has among the highest taxes in America on low-income individuals, including those who are below the poverty line. Corporations in Oregon, as a percent of their economic activity, now pay 71% less in state income taxes than they did 30 years ago. 30 years ago, they paid 19% of all income taxes collected in Oregon. Now they pay 4.6%, and that number is going down. Without tax breaks that were recently enacted, these corporations will be paying $900 million more in taxes than they do pay. And just a couple of weeks ago, there was an example of our delightful corporate kicker in Oregon. The kicker means that a state employee makes a forecast for the economy and a forecast of state revenue. And if that forecast then is changed by a later forecast and the forecast of state revenue goes up, then the corporations get back the difference. So just 3 weeks ago, corporate income taxes in Oregon were cut by 36%. Did you know that? 36% cut in corporate income taxes for the year 2005 happened 3 weeks ago. Did you see anything about that? Read about it? No. That's $101 million going back to the corporations. Half of it will go to 50 corporations. Oregon ranks second now in the United States in share of state and local taxes paid by individuals, not business. Second. We have the fifth highest income tax on a family of three earning the minimum wage. We have the second highest income taxes in the United States on a family of four at 125% of the poverty level. So we're collecting our money from the poor and not collecting it from the corporations. These campaign contributions also buy specific results. Just a couple of examples. In addition to, of course, the utilities, PGE and Enron, and the other utilities who are also charging us income taxes they don't pay. What about video poker and restaurants? Video poker parlors receive $160 million per year in commissions, and audits have shown those commissions could easily be cut in half, provide $80 million more for schools. But the Lottery Commission refuses to do that. Why is it? The commission is appointed by politicians, and the Oregon Restaurant Association contributed over $1.2 million to legislative candidates in the last three election cycles. What about the payday loans? Oregon also has no limits on interest rates that are charged. In the last legislative session, a Senate bill, which passed the Senate, I believe, would have limited interest to the reasonable rate of 391% per year. That was the limit, okay? That was the good bill, okay? Actually, it works out to 15% every 2 weeks. The payday loan industry then cranked up their money, contributed $141,000 to legislative candidates, and nothing passed. There are other examples, tobacco, et cetera. It goes on and on and on. Now, some people think, well, we don't really need limits on campaign contributions like the other 45 states. All that we need is disclosure. You just need to know who's giving the money. Well, when you see that a contribution is made by the Healthy Forest Alliance, who is that? How about the Citizens for Good Government? Who's that? Do you ever read about it in the paper, who they really are? I don't. The Pew Trust and UCLA Law School every year do a survey of campaign finance disclosure laws in the United States, all 50 states. Every year so far they've done the survey, most recently last year. Oregon earns a certain kind of a grade in what they call disclosure content accessibility and online usability. This means how much information is available to the public on campaign contributions. What grade do you think Oregon gets? Oregon is, well, it's A to F, okay? It's not, it's A, B, C, D, or F. Oregon, the good government state. Oregon, the clean state. F, every year, gets an F, because we have no online list of candidates or their contributors. We have no, Oregon has no, if you want to know who contributed to what to a candidate, you have to wait a year, and the Secretary of State puts out in a hardbound little book. There's no database. You can't look up any name and find out to whom that person or corporation has contributed. That's why Oregon is the worst in America when it comes to disclosing campaign contributions. Actually, they were ranked 45th out of 50. There are presumably five worse states. In the last legislative session, the legislature did enact a bill to require the Secretary of State to implement web-based electronic reporting with a searchable database, so that problem may be getting solved. But what we do need now is limits on campaign contributions. We enacted limits by a vote of 72% in 1994, but the Oregon Supreme Court struck them down in 1997. That's why we need a constitutional amendment, and that's Petition 8 that's on the streets now. And we have information here in the front for those who are interested, as well as at the Green Party table outside. We need first a constitutional amendment, then we need specific limits, and that's Petition 37 that we're collecting signatures on now. It would totally ban corporate contributions, like most states, ban labor union treasury contributions, like most states, limit individual contributions to $500 in a statewide race or $100 in a non-statewide race, which is similar to many other states, and it would limit what an individual can contribute to all candidate races in a particular year to $2,500, similar to the limit in Connecticut, a little bit lower than the limit in Arizona. Other states, like Massachusetts, it's $12,500, Rhode Island, it's $10,000, etc. So these limits would put Oregon in right up at the top when it comes to limits on campaign contributions. It would also allow the creation by anyone or any entity of small donor committees that receive only contributions from individuals and only in amounts of $50 or less per year. Small donor committees can then spend their money on anything that they want to. They can support any or all candidates that they want to. Our measure also limits the use of candidate personal wealth. When you have limits, sometimes you end up with only millionaires running for office. That happened in Oregon in the last contested Senate race. Where the Republican millionaire spent $2 million and won, and the Democratic millionaire only spent $1 million of his own money and lost. So we limit statewide candidates to using $50,000 of their own money and non-statewide candidates to $10,000. These kind of limits are on individual candidates' use of personal wealth are unusual. Some states do have them, like Tennessee, but they're not enforced. And finally, our measure controls independent expenditures. If you have limits on candidates, typically what happens is that you create things like 527s on the federal level. Under our measure, any such organization would have to function like a political committee. Their contributions to them would also be like a political committee. No corporations, no unions, only individuals, only limited amounts. And every ad they put out would have to be identified in the ad itself as to who they are. They'd have to identify their business, all of their business interests, like this is the timber companies, this is the drug companies, it's just not Citizens for Good Government, and the amount that they're spending on the independent expenditure campaign itself, and that would have to be in every ad, whether it's broadcast or in the newspaper. So we have a chance to go from being undoubtedly the worst state in America when it comes to campaign finance reform to being the best state. We're already about a third of the way there in collecting the signatures. We got an early start. The signatures are due next July. So for those of you who are in Oregon, and a lot of you are, please help us collect these signatures so that we can change Oregon, so Oregon can live up to its progressive reputation instead of being under the control of the corporations, which it is today. Thanks.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Dan. An exciting campaign, to be sure. So now I'm going to come back, because that's a state approach, which is a solid one. And now I'm going to focus in on what a local community might do based, again, not on theory, but on what's actually happening on the ground. But before I do, a couple of quick observations. One, when Dan was talking, he said, if the race is contested. Remember that was just one of the things that he said. Remember this, that unless and until we change our voting system away from the single-member district, winner-take-all current system and move towards either instant runoff voting or proportional representation, the fix is already in with these gerrymandered districts. No matter how much money you raise, the reality is these are not actually in play or actually contestable. Right? So when I say that this is a multi-tiered problem, I'm totally serious. We got to deal with the legal doctrines, we got to deal with the voting machines, we got to deal with the voting system, and we got to deal with the financing. Right? None of this is either or, it's all both and, if we're going to build a real democracy movement. Second thing, I just want to make an observation here, folks. Campaign financing itself is not actually based on something called contributions. At best, the monies that are being donated are investments. And they are richly rewarded with incredible returns. And if we're going to be honest, and we're truth tellers here, right? They're not even investments. They're bribes. We have legalized bribery. Right? That's what we're talking about. So, what are we doing now at the local level? And I first want to acknowledge in my short amount of time the in-corporate dominance or in-corporate personhood crew from here in Portland. Would you all stand up, please? Right over here in the corner. This crew is doing work. They've got a table outside. They're doing and moving in the direction that the local group I'm doing, because I travel the country lecturing, agitating, organizing, and I also believe that we have to organize where we live, on the ground, locally. And what we're doing is a countywide ballot initiative that would say we will not allow any outside corporations from making any contributions in our elections, period. Right? Period. And in my short amount of time, I'll ask you all to get out a pen or pencil if you'd like to get the website for this local campaign. And while you do, let me just give you the language that we use in our findings. In a democratic republic, all legitimate political power is held by the people, and government exercises just power only with the consent of the governed. Republicans love this language, by the way. We say, two, only natural persons possess civil and political rights. Corporations are creations of state law and possess no legitimate civil or political rights. Three, courts have illegitimately defined corporations as persons, allegedly vesting corporations with constitutional protections and rights. The unconstitutional doctrine of corporate personhood and corporate constitutional rights are illegitimately denying the people of Humboldt County the ability to exercise our fundamental political rights and our ability for self-governance. And then we track language from the U.S. Supreme Court that says we find these corporate contributions are undermining the confidence of the people of Humboldt County in the integrity of our elections. Then on the enforcement, we say any non-local corporation found to have contributed directly or indirectly any money or anything else to influence an election shall pay to the County of Humboldt 10 times the amount that the corporation inappropriately contributed. And if anyone is found to have inappropriately or illegally contributed more than $25,000, we direct the district attorney to petition the California Attorney General to initiate a charter revocation proceeding against that corporation. or to initiate a proceeding to revoke the corporation's certificate of authority to do business in the state of California. And lastly, this ordinance creates and vests in every citizen of Humboldt County the right to sue to compel compliance with this ordinance. So what I'm getting at, folks, this ordinance at the local level is taking self-government seriously. We are creating a campaign that empowers people, not only educates them about the corporate usurpation of our authority and our moral and ethical right, but it also is a direct, concrete campaign that people can work on. Here's that website. The group is called the Humboldt Coalition for Community Rights, and the website, www.votelocalcontrol.org. How's that for taking a right-wing frame and turning it on its head and using it? VoteLocalControl.org. And in the first week, and I think you'll appreciate this, Dan, as a signature gatherer, in the first week in a rural county, we collected over 1,000 signatures. We are having organized labor endorse. We are having the Green Party and the Democratic Party endorse. We are having elected officials endorse. We are changing the culture of Humboldt County. I want to urge everybody here that lives in Oregon to support the statewide initiative that Dan has just described, but I also want you to think about how powerful it would be in your community with your neighbors to start the process of changing your local community. And I would love to come back and do a full-day workshop on this with my friends at In Corporate Personhood, and let's make Portland, Oregon, the next state or the next local community to begin a nonviolent uprising against corporate rule. All right. So, how'd I do? So, we covered a lot of ground, but we saved ourselves 20 or 25 minutes for conversation. So, what I'd like to do is just ask folks if you want to make a comment or a question directed either to me or Dan. Let's just do a quick, you'll be number one. We'll do a quick stack. Number two, number three, stack of three. Number four, number one, ma'am.
That's why we need to pass petition. Excuse me? I think it was a comment that in order to have a local ordinance similar to that is being proposed in Humboldt County here in Oregon, we would first need to change the Oregon Constitution to allow limits or prohibitions on political campaign contributions, and that's correct. We, the voters of Oregon, back in 1994, enacted limits. The limits in ballot measure 9 of 1994 banned all corporate contributions, it banned all labor union contributions, and it limited contributions by individuals to, curiously enough, $500 in a statewide race and $100 in a non-statewide race. Sounds familiar.
So that's one answer.
And that was then, 3 years later, struck down by the Oregon Supreme Court as being contrary to Article 1, Section 8, the free speech clause of the Oregon Constitution. You might have also noticed that was in the paper today, in upholding the right of bars to have, you know, to portray various types of sexual activity. Oregon has, the Oregon courts at least, interpret its First Amendment in a way that is far more stringent than the U.S. Supreme Court interprets the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. For example, the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld campaign contribution limits, the ban on corporations, the ban on unions, limitations that are even lower than we are proposing in Oregon have all been upheld. There are other important cases at the U.S. Supreme Court. Just a couple of days ago, they decided to take the case out of Vermont. Vermont had enacted not only limits on campaign contributions, but overall limits on campaign spending. They said that no matter how much you receive in contributions, you can own a governor, someone running for governor, can only spend $300,000. Now, a spending limitation has not been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court before. It was upheld by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit a few months ago, and now the U.S. Supreme Court is going to take it. Cases on campaign finance limitations before the Supreme Court are actually pretty strange. They create strange bedfellows. In some instances, there are folks who support limitations whom you wouldn't expect. In particular, Justice Rehnquist, in many instances, was an upholder of limits.
So that's one answer, and it's a good, it'll get you an A+ on a law school exam, and it's absolutely correct on the law, as the Supreme Court currently says. But I'm clear when I say we have to build a movement that is going to undermine and delegitimize some of these Supreme Court decisions. Because let's be clear about something. The U.S. Supreme Court in Minor versus Happersett said the 14th Amendment does not apply to women, therefore laws forbidding women to vote are legal under the Constitution, including the 14th Amendment. The United States Supreme Court in Dred Scott said that no black man has any rights that a white man is bound to uphold, and any slave, even who escapes into so-called free territory, always is nothing more than property of the white slaveholder. The Supreme Court in Plessy versus Ferguson said separate but equal is perfectly valid under the 14th Amendment that says no person shall be denied equal protection of the laws and due process. Folks, the Supreme Court is wrong when they say that money is speech. We have to delegitimize that legal doctrine, and if it requires delegitimizing the United States Supreme Court, we are in good company. Where would we be today if the women's suffrage movement or the abolitionist movement or the trade union movement were willing to allow the Supreme Court to tell us what we could or couldn't do? So when I say that we're in an uprising in Humboldt County, I don't want to like oversell it, but I also want you to be clear. We know what we're doing. We are engaging in municipal civil disobedience. We are turning our city and our community into a social change agent that is daring to challenge the United States Supreme Court that is illegitimately preventing democracy. That's what we're doing, and I'm inviting you to join us. Number two. You have to turn it on. You want to come and...
First of all, is Tom Hartman going to speak at this?
Yes.
Okay, well, I don't want to steal his thing, but what you're talking about may be easier to do if after we hear what he says. No?
No.
Are you familiar with what he said?
Very familiar with Tom's work, and Tom would agree with you that it's not easy. It's not just an oops mistake of the Supreme Court, if that's what you're getting at.
Yeah. No, it's not just that, but it's... It still helps. But I don't want to spoil his surprise, though. It's
okay.
Sorry, you'll have to wait. I'm sorry.
Number three. Sure. So the question was, or the comment was, they're working in Olympia for a set of restrictions that say corporations cannot come and do business in our community unless they meet certain environmental labor safety laws. And they're having difficulty with some of the local business people to get on board and support it. How can we frame it and talk about it? I can actually tell you that this is... we've been laying the groundwork for our initiative for about a year in Humboldt County, and we actually have local business owners on board right now because we've done the education work and we've done the outreach. And the way that we've been able to do it is make it clear that we are not attacking the doctrine of limited liability, that this is only corporate constitutional rights, And then I go in and talk to them and explain how actually these huge transnational corporations are the only ones that ever utilize corporate constitutional rights to overturn laws. And, by the way, that when they do that, they are actually, these transnational large corporations are actually undermining local legitimate business interests. And we have begun the process of making it clear that we are not anti-business. In fact, we are pro-local business. That's one of the reasons why this says no non-local corporate contributions. Because we found that with both the unions and with local business people, if we just made blanket prohibitions, we weren't able to build the kind of constituency that we needed. So I'd be more than happy to engage with you in a little dialogue, outside of this context, and do a little role model with you and show you how we did that. But at the core of it has always been coming from a place of genuine respect with business owners. We are not attacking limited liability. We want to protect local businesses from the threat that these huge transnational corporations are posing. And they're buying it. And they're buying it because it's true.
Oregon and Washington often get lumped together and are considered by the rest of the country to be somewhat similar. While Oregon gets an F in campaign disclosure, Washington gets an A. In fact, it's ranked number one in campaign disclosure laws and in implementation by the various groups who rank those. In addition, of course, Washington does have limits on campaign contributions, similar to those that we're proposing, although a little bit higher. And Washington is one of the few states that limits the use of personal candidate wealth in elections. Under Washington law, but it's only during the 21 days before the election, no candidate for legislative office can spend more than $5,000 of her own money, and no candidate for statewide office can spend more than $50,000 of their own money. So there is a big difference. Now, Oregon in 1994 actually passed two statewide ballot measures on campaign finance reform. One of them was ballot measure 9 that I mentioned. The other one, as I recall, was ballot measure 5 or 6 that was brought to us by a dental surgeon in Salem. And that ballot measure also passed. And what that did is it prohibited all contributions to political candidates from anyone who was not an individual resident of that person's, of the district that that person was running in. It banned all corporate contributions. It banned all contributions from individuals who were not essentially the constituents of the person who was running. So Oregon voters have already enacted that also. But that was struck down by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals a couple of years later. So.
As another reason, delegitimate.
Right, violated the right of association, something like that.
Number 4, yes. It's www.votelocalcontrol.org. That's the campaign that we're running. If you want to contact me directly about the lectures and the education work that we do, that's very similar to the In Corporate Personhood group in Portland. I work with a group called Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, and this is really easy, www.duhc.org. Democracy Unlimited, Humboldt County, duhc.org. I travel about a week out of every month, meeting with at larger groups and smaller groups, basically helping to cultivate this strategy of non-reformist reforms. In other words, let's build and work on issues that are concrete and tangible, but that also will begin the process of changing the rules of the game so that we can continue to actually build this movement. So we're going to start another quick stack. If you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, please raise your hand. I think we finished up our one. Rick, I saw you. No? All right, well, 1, 2, 3, 4. Go ahead, 1.
It's because the well-funded candidate can communicate with voters. If you've got the money to put on TV ads and say that you're the greatest thing that's ever happened and your opponent is an idiot, then a lot of people get their information only from that. And it is demonstrated that the TV ads change votes. Now, in Oregon legislative elections, I live in a district that had a couple of the most contested races over the past couple of cycles, and what I would get every day in the mail is a giant postcard, or several giant postcards from the candidates, and, you know, extolling how great they are and you know, portraying their opponents as corrupt or idiots or something like that. Strangely enough, it has an effect. And if you can buy space in newspapers, if you can buy radio ads, if you can buy TV ads, then you win. That's you win about in Oregon about 92% of the time.
Number two. Thank you. We got 5 minutes, so we'll make the questions and the answers brief. Steve. Good luck to you, and I'm trying to find the people who have the courage of making this country what it was promised to be. It's that simple. I mean, if somebody is not willing to engage in this strategy and tactics, I respect that. But I know this, the only way you make systemic social change in this country is having the courage to demand it and act upon it. Number three. Perhaps. I mean, I would be willing to think about it, but I'll tell you this. I've seen nothing in the Supreme Court that is deserving of that level of respect. Those are corporatist and militarist, and all of their opinions are basically supporting it. So you and I have a difference of opinion about how much esteem to hold those 9 unelected people. I am. I'm a radical Democrat, little d Democrat. Number four.
This question is to Dan with regard to your initiative on finance, campaign, finance reform. Assuming that it would pass, I'm wondering what would prevent the tax from outside Oregon from buying and influencing through television ads or buying newspaper ads and so on.
Well, any communication with Oregon voters about an election you know, to attempt to influence the outcome of it would be considered under the law an expenditure, and corporations would be banned from making expenditures. It would be illegal. It would be a crime. And I can do David's ordinance. I can trump him on one thing. Our measure says that each violation of any provision of this act shall be punishable by the imposition of a civil fine, which is not less than 5 times, nor more than 20 times the amount of the unlawful contribution or expenditure. So,
dueling initiatives.
Right. So it would be, right now, almost every election law violation in Oregon is a Class C felony that carries with it a potential penalty of 5 years in prison and a $100,000 fine. So these would fit into that. I mean, if you sign an initiative more than once knowingly, then that's a Class C felony in Oregon. So it would be a crime. And also in our measure, we don't depend upon the Attorney General or Secretary of State to enforce it. We also have citizen enforcement provisions that if the AG or Secretary of State don't take action, then individual citizens can bring actions to recover the amount of the penalties to be paid to the to be paid to the state treasury. So it would be illegal.
Thank you, Dan. Our time is up. This is a rich conversation, and I think that we've only begun to scratch the surface. I do want to remind folks that Dan and I will be here through the entire weekend. We hope that we've provoked some thought and discussion at the local level. If you live in Portland, In Corporate Personhood is a group that I would encourage you to hook up with. The National Alliance for Democracy basically exists because of the premise that corporations have hijacked our government, so there's a national organization that's working on it. And if you want me to come to your local community to help to strategize and conspire with you, and damn right I'll use that word, to conspire with you on how to help to nurture a movement for that kind of municipal civil disobedience to provoke and win the nonviolent revolution to make real the promise of democracy, contact me through Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County. Peace.
Before you go, there are snacks downstairs, and Mr. Cobb has generously agreed to continue a debate that spontaneously started about a half hour or 45 minutes ago, and we will continue the debate during the break. So go down, have a snack, and hear a debate about fusion voting and IRV. And try to be back here, or be back here at 3:30, please.
So I didn't repeat enough of them.
3:30 is 15 minutes from now. That would be 3:30 Pacific time. And you're listening to the National Summit to Save Our Elections, coming to you from the First Unitarian Church in Portland, Oregon. It's a three-day event. And it continues today. We were just listening to David Cobb and Dan Meek. They were discussing how to confront corporate rule. I'm here with I'm Otis McClay, here with Pokey Anderson. Both of us are from Texas. And Pokey can be heard on KPFT. And kpftx.org on the stream. Sunday Monitor every Sunday at 7 Eastern. And maybe we'll be doing it from here. We're not sure yet. Dan Meek, actually, we were talking about bios before. He's a leading legal advocate for campaign finance reform and utility reform in the state of Oregon. And he also serves as the senior energy advisor and legal counsel for the U.S. House Committee on Interior Affairs, something that Oregonians seem to be involved in.
He had quite a number of rather revelatory statistics about the current situation in Oregon.
Yeah.
Corporations are paying 4.6% of taxes in Oregon, down from something like 17% some years ago. And if you're one of the people who gave money to an Oregon political campaign in a $50 or less slot, that all of you all together only gave 2% of the political money. So
Where is the money coming
from? If you're a small donor, you may be wondering who's getting access. Now you probably have some idea. The majority of the political contributions in Oregon were given by 1,200 people. That actually is more than in Texas. The Texas number is something like 65.
People.
65 people or families gave the majority of money in I think it was in one of the midterms recently. And so you're talking about concentration of wealth, concentration of power. You're looking at it here in this political system.
And, of course, that's theoretically what this whole thing is about.
Well, and as David Cobb said, many of these reform proposals seem insurmountable in and of themselves, but actually there's several layers to this whole ball of wax, including dealing with the computers that are counting or not counting the votes, dealing with the districts that most of them, for instance, for U.S. congressional races, are not competitive, meaning that they've been drawn and gerrymandered in such a way that it's almost impossible for someone of one party to win. It's going to almost always be the whatever, Republican,
whatever
Democrat, whoever it was drawn for. So there's the districting problem, the computers in elections problem, one of the solutions that they're going to be talking about later will be proportional voting or instant runoffs, and also, of course, campaign finance. And David talked a bit about, well, a fair amount about Humboldt County and some of their draconian proposals. Draconian for corporations, anyway.
Humboldt County, and a very interesting part of California, in many respects. The interesting thing about all of these
proposals... It's not Selma, Alabama. Let's say that.
Not Humboldt County.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about the whole issue of the idea of these proposed reforms, and this is a question for you, all of them have to go essentially and be approved by people who've been elected.
Or who have been tabulated as being elected.
Well, okay, exactly. But put there by some kind of system that assumes that there were votes somewhere.
Right.
And the tendency, of course, is for people who get elected under a system, or whatever you want to call it, you know, whatever the word...
Selected, tabulated,
under a system,
yeah.
Would be to oppose any changes in that system.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's one of the things that tends to cross party lines. And so, it raises that whole issue of how do we take that power back from the government. I mean, David Cobb did that wonderful little breakdown of the Constitution and how the power is supposed to be laid out, and it seems to be upside down. Do you have any comment on that, Pokey?
Well, actually, in some ways, and this is hard to show on the radio, but if you've ever seen an Escher drawing, you get the idea. It's like you go up the staircase, but where did the staircase go? And I think the citizens have been put in a situation of, here's the staircase of, call and write your congresspeople who may or may not have been elected and tell them to, change the system so that somebody else has a chance. That staircase doesn't seem to go anywhere. Those letters and calls don't seem to have had any real effect. We are in a bit of trouble here, trying to figure out how to get some traction. But I think it's helpful to remember that, as was said not too long ago here, women got the vote, and they didn't get it because somebody gave it to them.
Right.
Men had to vote to give women what they already deserved and should have had already, which was the vote. And certainly there was plenty of men who didn't want to do it, but they were forced to. They had to. Women marched and went on hunger strikes and went to jail and did everything for 75 years. Hopefully this will be a little quicker. We'll see. But again, they
was
were...
Was it only 75 years?
Well, at least.
Was it really in the 1840s then?
Well, they...
Lucy Stoner showed up then. And
they, okay, so... But
it seems to me for like it's been a long,
maybe
long,
80
long
years.
Haul.
Yeah, it was... Yeah, you remember that, eh?
Yeah. I'm an old man.
This is Pokey Anderson. I'm here with Otis McClay, our technical genius, and we're broadcasting live in Portland, Oregon, from the
National Summit to Save Our Elections.
There you go.
And, they refer to it as a call to rescue our democracy. It's coming from the First Unitarian Church here in downtown Portland, Oregon. A rainy day.
Right.
The kind of day that, interestingly enough, they said they haven't had one of these in a long time.
Yeah.
And I believe Portland is famous for this. Gosh, I wonder what's going on.
It's beginning to be fall.
This is put together actually by about 12 different coalitions or six. I was talking with somebody, with Nancy Mattella, as one of the organizers out front, and it's a pretty large. I mean, I know the Multnomah Democrats are involved, and There are a bunch of, I think, the Green Party's involved. There are a number of people that put this together. And I think it's actually kind of interesting. And the thing that I wonder about with things like this is, why isn't this place overflowing? I mean, here we are talking about the basic underpinnings of the nation and how it's run. And, you know, where's the outrage? That question continues for me.
Well, you know,
we're very comfortable in this country.
No, we're not comfortable, but I think too many people don't have a clue on what the problem is. And then, of course, even many of those who seem to understand the problem are still grappling with what the solution might be. You know, as I was driving up here from Texas all the way to Oregon, I noticed in small towns and large, there were signs, help the hurricane survivors, help the pets of hurricane survivors. There's stuff on front pages of little newspapers and big newspapers. All the different things that citizens were compelled to do, that felt moved to do, whether it was donate their time, travel down. I met somebody from the Red Cross who was traveling down all the way from Idaho to Mississippi to go and help. All the things that people are willing to do to help somebody, you know, who's been sitting on their roof trying to get to a safe place or some food or whatever it is people need to survive. And yet, those images were broadcast in stark, you know, stark detail day after day, and people got it. The image of our democracy drowning and starving is not anywhere to be found on the major media. And of course, you know, we've talked about this before, Otis.
Mm-hmm.
But until we have more and more ways to get the word out that our democracy is drowning and that we need every bit as much help as the survivors of Katrina and Rita to save this democracy, then I guess we're going to continue to see people putting their efforts into many worthy things, but not necessarily this thing that seems to me, and I've been working on this for 2.5 years, to be the one of the very most important underpinnings of the mess that we're in.
Is the voting system?
Is the voting system.
The system itself or the counting, I guess?
Well, the counting is certainly a top priority to me, because even if you fix campaign finance reform, if you still don't count the votes right, then you haven't gotten anywhere. So I think you got to count the votes right, and then, maybe, as they were saying, do it all at the same time, but certainly, if one programmer, one corrupt programmer, can steal an entire state's votes, then you got a big problem. Even if 49 states are accurate, you still got a big problem if that state happens to be Florida or Ohio or
a swing state.
A swing state.
one of the things that I'm, you know, with the Bork hearings, was fascinating to me, because what the Constitution says in the Bill of Rights very clearly is that the purpose of the Constitution, and this was David Cobb was saying, was to limit the power of the government.
Mm-hmm.
The Constitution's job is to limit the power of the government. And when Bork's showed up and we started having that thing, we got this this constitutional concept that somehow you don't have a right unless the Constitution gives it to you.
Right.
The whole thing was turned on its head.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, people actually seem to believe that. I mean, that seems to be, because people are actually talking about that as though that were true. And what the Bill of Rights says, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, say anything not stated in the Constitution is specifically reserved for the states and for the people thereof, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. But
yeah.
It said that if the government has not reserved a right for itself in the Constitution, then that right belongs to the people. And we still have this issue of the right of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow
you said
privacy
Bork.
Well, this was the issue with Bork.
Yeah.
Since privacy is not mentioned in the Constitution, Bork was making the assumption that it belonged to the government.
Now, you second Bork or Roberts? You're talking
about? No, I'm talking about Robert Bork.
Okay.
That this came up 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
when Bork was, eventually passed over for the Supreme Court nomination. And then what Nixon gave us, Haynesworth and Carswell.
Hmm.
you know, there is this whole thing about the, yeah, absolutely, we're on the air. There was this whole thing about somehow we've completely reversed the relationship of government to the people. And that's what David Cobb was talking about. And just giving us this quick primer in the Constitution saying that the people have rights, the government has responsibilities. That the government is limited and people have rights. And that's been completely reversed, and nobody gets it. Nobody gets it. People seem to think that that we work for the president. Well, actually, we pay his salary. He's an employee of the people of the United States. And yet we treat him as though he were a king. And, you know, there's something very crazy out here about all this. And that's why I'm kind of wondering how to... this comes back to what you were saying. You know, people need to be reminded how this system works. I guess the schools aren't teaching this right now. They're more worried about creationism or whatever they're calling it, intelligent design.
Or passing the test might be.
Something that really makes a difference, by the way, in our lives. You know, how it happened. I'm being ironic here.
Let's
we're actually getting down. Okay, I've done my rant.
Let's look a little bit ahead here. Shortly we'll be resuming the hearing or the conference, and the next up will be Electoral Systems 101. What are IRV, which is instant runoff voting, and PR, proportional representation. So talk a little bit about those things with Steve Chesson. And then this is something that I had mentioned to you before, Otis, that I'm really looking forward to. At 4:30, here on this same station, you are going to hear about New Mexico's election results and some of the testimony that's been coming out in sworn depositions. This will be presented by Holly Jacobson. And they've got some, I think, sizzling hot stuff from insiders who are, again, under oath, talking about the inadequacies, to say the least, of some of the various voting systems that have been used in New Mexico. New Mexico kind of is not on most people's radar. Most people would say, oh, yeah, there's been some scuffles in Florida and, you know, scuffles in Ohio. But most people aren't aware that New Mexico had a whole bunch of anomalies. There was a very diligent attempt by the Greens to recount New Mexico with all kinds of blockades thrown up by the Democratic administration of that state, the governor and the secretary of state. And those anomalies are still being looked at. I mean, they had ghost voting where, you only have 150 people registered or showed up and you have 300 votes. How did that happen? You know, they have ghost towns in New Mexico, but do those ghosts vote? It's like Ohio, where you have a ton of anomalies, and it's hard to like list them all and keep focused. But basically, there's a lot to look at in New Mexico. Again, 4:30 for that, 4:30 Pacific time, if you want to hear about some of those anomalies, and then later on. The conference plenary starts at 6:30 Pacific, and we'll have some more speakers going until 9 o'clock Pacific. And assuming that the creek don't rise, we'll be here today, tomorrow, and Sunday.
That's right.
And so tell your friends. We just now have kind of started to get the word out. If
we'll see about Sunday. I'm not sure about Sunday.
Okay.
Sunday actually is at a different place. And
right.
I'm not sure that.
Tell folks that you know that might be interested in this or that should be interested in this to give us a listen.
This is what's coming up now is going to be that's the presenter, Steve Chesson, and he is the president of Californians for Electoral Reform. And I'm just looking down this long list. He's done a lot of stuff. He's been active in the voting area for a long time. And it says here that he's been interested in election systems, which is, of course, what instant runoff voting would be one of those. Ever since he went to college in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where they use choice voting, and the billboards read, "Vote Jane Smith, #1 for city council." So I guess you can vote
more numbers than one.
I guess so.
Maybe you have more. You know, I mean, there are systems where you can essentially give your choice of all the candidates and then add that up. I don't know how that works, but that's what we're going to find out. They're trying to get people back into the room now. And, you know, once you let them leave, especially if there's food.
Well, and there's concurrent sessions going on in the right. In the other room,
the
too.
The debate with David Cobb, which is being recorded, by the way. We can't really stream them both. Well, I suppose we could, but we didn't. So you're listening to the National Summit to Save Our Elections, coming to you from the First Unitarian Church here in Portland, Oregon. And we're going to be here until about midnight Eastern. I think it ends sometime around 9 tonight Pacific. And we're about 5 minutes late now starting this session, but I could be wrong, and maybe we're beginning
no,
right
that's
now.
That's right. Oh, here we go.
So this is Steve Chesson. Well,
people are still coming in, sitting down.
Yeah, maybe the activity's downstairs for this one. David Cobb, who is kind of a fun debater.
Yeah, he's fun to listen to.
Is debating on the issue of I guess, the effect of these kinds of systems that, I mean, for instance, I think, is it Santa Rosa? There's some towns in California that have implemented these systems for their local elections, I know. And I'm thinking, you know, Marin County.
One of the things that's happened in this national movement is that local activists and elected officials have started at least sharing some of their, you know, some of the things that might work or might not work. For instance, this business of campaign reform that they're trying to push in Oregon, you know, they talked to the people in Arizona and Maine and said, hey, how's that working for you? And, you know, that's one of the neat things about having states is that a state can try something out. It doesn't have to be done federally and see if it works. And then other states might want to try it. Look, here we go.
Saying?
Thank you. My name is Steve Chesson. I'm president of Californians for Electoral Reform. And the title of this talk is Electoral Systems 101, What Are Instant Runoff Voting and Proportional Representation? So I'm going to, you probably heard those terms bandied about in earlier talks today, and I'm going to let you know what they are. How many people here are from Oregon? Can I see hands? How many people here are not from Oregon? Where are you from, sir? California? Washington? Anybody else? Where are you from? Nevada? Anybody else from someplace else? Texas over there, great. Okay, wonderful. Originally from Ohio. Okay. Well, I'm from California. So most of the people here are from Oregon. So let me ask you, what is the name of the electoral system that you use to elect the governor in Oregon? Anybody know? Da 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 da. Sir. Winner take all. Well, actually, it's a kind of winner take all system. There are four kinds of winner-take-all systems. I'm looking for the particular one where you're electing one person and whoever gets the most votes wins, even if it's not a majority. Okay, there's a name for that. But before I tell you what the name is, I want to tell you what it means when you don't know what the name is. It means you don't think about it. It's just the electoral system. It's just how we elect people. It never occurs to you that there might be different ways of electing people. You just take it for granted like the air around you. Well, the name of the system that's used to elect the governor in Oregon and the governor in Washington and the governor in California and in almost every state except possibly Louisiana is called first past the post. It comes from the British. It's a horse racing expression. It comes from the British. If you think of a horse race, you've got this finish post and the horses are all running along. And I need three hands. Anyway, but the horse that crosses the finish post first, gets their nose past the post first, is the winner. And the same thing with elections when you do plurality elections, when you're electing one person. You get a ballot. You get to put an X next to you, the person you want, your favorite person, the one you want to vote for, the one you feel you have to vote for. And then they sort the ballots out by those choices. And they make piles. And some piles are higher than others. And you take that post and you hold it horizontally. And you lower it. And the first pile to go past that post is the winner. First past the post. It has all sorts of negative consequences. It leads to spoiler effects, as we saw in New Hampshire and Florida in the 2000 election, where George Bush won those states without getting a majority of the votes, because if you took Ralph Nader and Al Gore and added them together, there was actually more than what Bush got. But there's other kinds. That's one kind of winner-take-all system. There's other kinds of winner-take-all systems. Let me tell you about another kind of winner-take-all system. It's called instant runoff voting. And can we warm up the projector, please? Just warm it up, okay? Don't take that book down yet. In instant runoff voting, you rank your candidates. You put a one next to your first choice, a two next to your second, a third next to your third choice, and so on. Basic principle behind instant runoff voting is we get a majority winner in a single election without the necessity of a second runoff election. Louisiana uses a two-round runoff system. All the candidates face each other in September, I think it is. If someone gets a majority in the first round, they win. If no one gets a majority, the top two vote-getters have a November runoff. That's still a winner-take-all system because only one person wins and they get all the representation. But that takes two elections. Instant runoff, you do it with one election. And the way that works is that you sort the ballots out by first choice. If someone gets a majority of first choices, then they win. If no one gets a majority, you eliminate the candidate at the bottom, and then you recount all the ballots. And if your first choice is still in the race, your ballot stays with your first choice. But if your first choice was eliminated, then your ballot moves to your second choice. You recount all the ballots. If someone now has a majority, that person wins. Otherwise, you repeat this process iteratively. We're going to do a little video now that'll show you in a little bit more detail how this works. This video was developed for a San Francisco campaign, and as such, it has a definite liberal lean to it. I think that's okay for this audience, but when I give this talk, these talks elsewhere. They also use an older name, by the way. They call it preference voting. So let's go to the first clip, please.
Up all first-choice votes, candidate Smith is in last place with only two votes. So he is eliminated. But both voters who rank Smith first haven't wasted their votes. Instead, their votes are transferred to the next choice indicated on their ballots. One voter prefers Garcia as his second-choice candidate. The other voter prefers Wong. After transferring these votes, there is still no candidate with the majority of votes. So now, the liberal candidate Garcia has the fewest votes and is eliminated. It turns out that all of Garcia's voters prefer the remaining liberal candidate Wong to the more conservative candidate Washington. Wong receives all four votes. He wins the election. Note how preference voting made a difference. Without transferring any votes, the conservative Washington would have won because the majority of liberal voters split their votes among three rival liberal candidates. But with preference voting, voters express their true preferences without settling for the lesser of two evils or worrying that their candidate was a spoiler. Even though Washington won six first-choice votes, Her conservative base of support was narrow. Most supporters of the other two candidates ranked the more liberal Wong ahead of Washington. Jane Doe, for example, ranked Garcia first and Wong second. After Garcia lost, Jane's vote helped give Wong a majority. Wong had more support than Washington among all voters and won the election, as is only fair. That's how we elect a single winner with preference voting.
Are there any questions so far? Sir. Okay, the question is, some people think this is too complicated for hand-counted paper ballots. What do I think? Well, let me show you how they do this in Australia. It's a good setup. That is a instant runoff voting ballot that they use in Australia. Australia elects their House of Representatives, their lower house of their two-house government this way. And the way it works is you rank the candidates. Let's say I want to vote for... a lot of Greens here. I'll vote for Bob Goodale, a Green Party candidate first, and then Kim Beazley is my second choice, and Malcolm is my third choice, and Clive is my fourth, etc., 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 all the way down the ballot. Australia actually requires you to rank all the candidates, but most implementations of instant runoff don't require that. And then they count these by hand. So it's pretty simple. But in this country, we tend to prefer doing things with machines. San Francisco used this system for the first time in its November election. This is basically what the ballot looked like. This is electronic systems and software. Connect the arrows. They have three columns. You select your first choice in this column. You select your second choice in that column. Your third choice in that column. Fairly simple. Most of the voters understood and liked this system. One of the downsides of this particular implementation is it limits you to three choices, which isn't so bad if you've only got five or six people running, but in one of the districts they had 22 candidates. And so when you limit to your people to ranking three, you can vote sincerely for your first two choices, but then your third choice you have to think hard and fast about, well, who are the front runners in this race? And who do I want to vote my third strategic choice to? This is the ballot that they use in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's a bubble sheet. This is actually Diebold. Diebold election system has the best optical scan interface for instant runoff voting, despite all their other problems. You circle a bubble for your first choice, another bubble for your second, another I can write in somebody. You know, Jane Doe. Make her my third choice, fourth choice, etc. Very simple. Touch screens are even simpler. The first one you touch is your first choice, the second is your second, the third is your third, etc. Prints out on your voter verified paper trail. So there's no danger with that. And what we did in San Francisco is we posted the raw ballot data. And basically a record for every ballot, what the first, second, third choice was of every ballot, on a website. So people could download the ballots and do their own counting, write their own software. The Center for Voting Democracy provided software, but people could write their own, to verify that the Elections Department in San Francisco was actually counting the ballots accurately. So it's a very simple thing. But the problem with instant runoff voting is it's still a winner-take-all system. Whoever wins, gets the majority, wins, and everybody else is without representation. So let me motivate why we want proportional representation. And let's talk about a town with about 50 people in it. Anybody here ever been to a New England-style town meeting? New England-style town meeting. Oh, good. That means if I say something wrong, you won't be able to correct me. New England-style town meeting, everybody gets together once or twice a year, and they debate all the issues about, were we going to raise money to fix the streets or whatever. And even crazy Uncle Harry, who thinks the potholes are caused by UFOs coming down in the middle of the night and landing hard on the streets, He gets to go to the mic and says that, you know, what we need to do in this town is pass a no overnight UFO parking ordinance, and that would solve the problem. So he gets to say that, and people nod, and then he sits down, and then people talk about, okay, how are we going to raise money for the asphalt and the steamrollers and all those kinds of things that we're going to need to do. So we've got this town of about 50 people, and on some particular issue, let's say it's development, there's basically three lines of thought in this town. There's the A faction of about 10 people that is no growth. They like things the way that they are. They don't want to see any change. The B faction is about 30 people, and they're moderate growth people. They realize you need, if you don't grow, you die. At least that's their belief. But they don't want, you know, the whole town to turn into one vast shopping mall. And then you've got another small faction of 10 people, the C people, who believe, you know, growth, unlimited growth is the best thing since sliced bread, and that's what they want. So they get together and they debate the issues, and if the issue doesn't fall along development lines, then of course they vote differently. And they decide, you know, we're too busy with our lives, you know, raising our kids and everything. We've got our jobs. We're too busy to do this town meeting style of government. We're going to elect a 5-member city council. So they decide we're going to have a 5-member city council, and the best way of doing it is everybody gets to vote for 5 people. This is another winner-take-all system called block vote. Everybody gets to vote for 5 people, and the top 5 vote-getters win. So the A people get together, and they put up their slate of 5 candidates, and the B people get together, and they put up their slate of 5 candidates, and the C people get together, put up their slate of 5 candidates, and there's campaigning and mailers and door-to-door precinct walking. And on election day, everybody goes to the polls and votes. And the A voters, there's 10 of them, they don't elect anybody. The C voters, there's 10 of them, they don't elect anybody. The B voters, there's 30 of them, they're the majority, they elect everybody. So all you have on the council are the B people. And if you're an A or a C person, the only time you get to have input to the city council, aside from making an appointment, is during that public hearing portion where you go up to the microphone. This is how it works in California. I'm not sure how this works the same way in Oregon. You get to go to the microphone, and you get to speak for 2 or 3 minutes, and maybe they listen to you, and maybe they do the crossword puzzle behind the dais. And then you sit down, and somebody else gets up to speak. And eventually they turn off the microphone, and the 5 city council people debate amongst themselves as to what they're going to do. And if one of them says something that's factually incorrect, and you know it, well, you're in the audience, the microphone's been turned off, you can't really do anything about it. You could try shouting out, but they might, you know, eject you from the room. And if none of the other 4 people behind the table realizes that this was factually incorrect, they're going to make a decision based on incorrect information. Has anybody here ever experienced that? Gone to your city council meeting? Yes, you understand. Okay. Well, anyway, the people in the city realize this isn't fair, that they're leaving out representation of 40% of the community, and so the newspapers editorialize about that. We need to do something different in this town. So what do we do in this town when we don't like at-large elections? What do we change them to? Anybody? Precincts, okay, or districts. We make single-member districts, just like we elect our representatives to Congress with single-member districts. So we're going to have, you know, an independent citizens commission draw the lines, make it nice and fair. We won't let the politicians draw their own districts. And they draw nice straight lines. And on election day, you know, and the A people, every district, there's an A running and a B running and a C running. And the League of Women Voters holds debates in every district, and the candidates debate, and they send out mailers, and they talk to the newspapers, and they get endorsements, and they talk to their neighbors. And on election day, people go to the polls, and they vote. And as it turns out, there's a majority of B voters in every district because we don't have the A's concentrated in one location and the B's concentrated in another. They're pretty homogenous throughout the community. We get a B from every district. Well, there's something wrong with this. People realize this is no better than before. We got to do something different. And newspapers editorialize it, said, well, you know, we had an independent redistricting commission. What went wrong here? We got to do something different. So what do we do that's different? Anybody? Gerrymandering. Well, we draw different lines. Now, these lines aren't so straight. But they do provide broad representation on the council. We make sure that, you know, these two districts can elect an A and this district can elect a C. So is this fair? No? I see people shaking their heads. Why isn't this fair? Well, it's artificial. Okay, but it's not fair for another reason. The B's, there's 30 B's in the town. They're 60% of the community. They should have 60% of the seats by rights. They should have a majority on the council, but they don't. They only have two of the five seats. The A's are 20%. They're entitled to one seat, but because of the way the districts are drawn, they get two. It's only the C's who happen to have their fair share of representation, and that's just by the way the lines were drawn. So again, this isn't fair, and the newspapers editorialize against it, and they decide we've got to do something different. And what they do is different because that's the only thing we know how to do in this country. We do what's called a fair gerrymander. How's that for an oxymoron? We draw the lines. We guarantee that three of the districts will elect a B, one will elect an A, and one will elect a C. And in District 2, the way we guarantee that, we don't quite have a majority of the A's. We have four. That's a plurality because there's three B's and three C's. So 60% of that district would actually prefer somebody else than the person who won. So this isn't fair. And if you used instant runoff voting instead of a plurality first past the post here, well then, yeah, maybe the B's and C's would form a coalition and put up a candidate and you'd get a B or a C elected, but that would upset the balance of the fair gerrymander. And it's even worse than that. And you're going to get copies of this to take home with you as a homework exercise. And I'm going to... I have the sheets up here, and I'm going to ask somebody to pass them out in a minute. Let's say we've got a much smaller town. Here it's only 25 people. And we have 9 X's and 16 O's. The O's are a majority, and the X's are a minority. But we want fair representation for everybody. We're going to draw some districts. And we're going to make them nice and not gerrymandered. So we'll make this first one like that, the second one like that, third one like that, fourth one like that, fifth one like that. Well, this district will elect an X because there's a majority of X's. This will elect an O. This will elect an X, and that will elect an O, and that will elect an X. So we end up with 3 X's and 2 O's. A minority of the voters have a majority of the seats on the council. This is what gerrymandering allows you to do. You only need to control slightly more than half the vote and slightly more than half the districts to control the legislature. 26% of the people can overrule the other 74%. Well, let's draw the districts differently then. We didn't like that result. X, O, X, O, X. Well, you know, hey, that's the same result. We got to be more clever. We can't use these straight lines. So let's use circles. Or some kind of curve. Okay, these four outer districts, they're all the same shape. These are pretty, you know, they're not Z-shaped or splattered or anything. And we have the central district. And now we've got, gee, these districts have three O's and two X's, so they each elect an O. And the central district has four O's and an X, so it elects an O. And you can dial any result you want between 5-0 and 3-2 with how you draw the lines. Now, there is a way, and this is where I'm going to ask you, and I'll give you some more here. And can you please bring the extras back to me? Make sure everybody gets one. On side B, you'll see what I just did. On side A, you'll have a blank. You can draw 5 districts such that 2 of the districts will elect an X. The X's will be a majority in 2 of the districts, and the O's will be a majority in 3 of the districts. But as you're drawing those lines, consider this. You are determining, you on the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission, you are determining which X voter gets to live in an X district and which X voter gets to live in an O district, and vice versa. you are determining the character of each person's representation long before the voters get to go to the polls to choose, or maybe we should say to ratify, your decision about who should represent them. So that's the fundamental problem with single-member districts. And it doesn't matter. Yes, it's egregious if the politicians draw their own lines, but having independent citizens' commissions draw the lines doesn't really help matters. So what we really want is proportional representation, where the 30B voters get to elect 3B representatives and the 10As get to elect an A and the 10Cs get to elect a C, where it's done citywide, where the seats are allocated. The basic principle behind proportional representation is majority rule with fair representation for the electoral minority in direct proportion to how people vote. So that if you're part of a 60% community, 60% block of voters, you get 60% of the seats, not all of them. And if you're part of an electoral minority that only represents 20% of the community, you get 20% of the seats instead of nothing. As a matter of fact, our founding fathers wanted proportional representation. John Adams said legislatures in the United States should be an exact portrait in miniature of the people at large, as it should think, feel, reason, and act like them. The only problem was our Constitution was written in the latter half of the 18th century, and the principles behind proportional representation weren't invented until the first part of the 19th century, around the 1830s. So they just didn't have the tools. But let's look at some of the consequences of proportional representation. Well, actually, before I do that, I want to show you some of the countries where they use proportional representation. The countries in red use first-past-the-post like we do. First-past-the-post like we do. Winner-take-all, United States, Canada, some countries in Africa, India. Basically, the former British colonies, as David Cobb said before. The countries in yellow and in brown and in green, light green, use various kinds of proportional representation. I'll be talking about the systems in a few minutes. The countries in blue use a two-round runoff system, like France does, to elect their legislature. But you can see a lot of countries use proportional representation. And that's because they established their democracies after these principles were established. Now, this shows women elected to the lower house of a particular country, with one exception here. It's 1991 figures, so it's a little bit out of date, but the relative heights of these bars are still the same, are still true today. And we see that the countries that use proportional representation, those on the right-hand side of the chart, elect far more women to their legislatures than countries that use single-member districts. And some people might say, well, these countries are different. The ones that use PR are different than the countries that don't use PR, and that explains the difference here. It has nothing to do with the system. But we actually have a control group here. Oh, by the way, in 1992, United States, that was the year of the woman, remember? So we went from 5% to 12% in the House of Representatives. That's still nothing compared to the Norwegian countries, Scandinavian countries. Australia appears on both sides of this chart, because Australia uses single-member districts for their lower house and proportional representation for their Senate. And they elect far more women to the Senate using proportional representation than they do to the lower house. And these are the same voters, the same political parties, the same voting precincts, the same election day. So the only thing that explains the difference is the fact that they're using proportional representation. And we can look at controlled studies in other countries. I talked about Australia. In 1983, 5% of their lower house was women. And I use women because gender, that's a good way of measuring things, because women are roughly half the population. In the Senate, 20% were women in 1983. As strides were made in the 80s and 90s, more women were getting elected. It went up to 15% in the House, up to 31% in the Senate. So, you know, two to four times as many women getting elected under proportional representation than under winner-take-all systems. Germany elects half their house using single-member districts and the other half using a proportional system I'll talk about in a minute. And again, 1983, 4% of the seats in the district seats were women, and 16% of the list of the proportional seats were women. 1994, the lower house went up to the single member seats went up to 13% women. The list seats went up to 39. So again, a factor of 3 or 4. New Zealand, prior to 1993 and prior, they used single member districts just like we do. 20% of their legislature was female. They switched election systems. So that in 1996, they put in a German-style system. 15% of the single-member districts had women. 45% of the proportional seats had women. So they increased overall to 29%, but the vast majority, vast part of that increase was done in the proportional side of the House. We can also look at ethnicity. This is a bit of an eye chart. But what this shows is the elections for the New York City Community School Boards, which were elected using proportional representation until they were abolished a year or two ago. And what we have here on the left is the population of various ethnic groups in 1975. And on the right, the breakdown of the ethnicity, not by population, but percent of registered voters in 1993, so we're spanning a 20-year span. Excuse me. And let's take, for example, Asians. That's a good example because they went from 0.3% of the population to 2.3% of the population. So the percentage of seats won by Asians went, you know, from 1 or under 1% to above 2% as they increased. Minorities overall went from 37% to 46%. The percentage elected 35, 37, 45, 44, 47, 52. So basically, proportional representation allows the representation of the legislative body to mirror changes in the population without artificial districts. Cincinnati City Council is a very interesting study. They instituted proportional representation in 1925. Is this the chart that I want to show? Yes. Okay. And as the black population slowly increased from 1925 through 1955, we saw African Americans getting elected to the Cincinnati City Council. So when you have a 9-member city council, you basically need about 10% of the vote to elect somebody. So in 1931, the black population elected their first representative. They were about 11% of the population. And then that person was lost in 1933. They elected somebody else in 1935. And we see pretty much throughout the 30s and 40s the African American population being able to elect somebody. As the population grew in the post-war era, we saw two African Americans getting elected in 1951. The black population was 16.7% of the vote, so clearly some white voters were joining with the African American voters to elect two blacks. And up through, again, in the early 50s, at least one black representative. And something interesting happened. The system in Cincinnati was such that of the people who were elected, the person who got the most first-choice votes, they used the system where you rank the candidates, the person who got the most first-choice votes would be the mayor. Well, the black population got together and said, well, we're going to put up one or maybe two candidates, but we're going to make sure that we all list this one person first. And then we'll list our other choices, second, third, etc. And the white population couldn't get their act together. And they were going to divide their votes up. So that what was threatening to happen in 1957 is that not only were the blacks going to get their one or two representatives on the council that they were entitled to, they were also going to end up electing the mayor. And the white establishment couldn't stand for that. So they put a repeal measure on the ballot in 1956 to repeal proportional representation and go back to an at-large, winner-take-all, vote for nine, the nine top vote-getters win, what they call the 9X system, because you make 9Xs on the ballot. And it won, it passed like by a 3-to-1 margin. You know, the entire black population, progressive white community voted against it, but they weren't able to fight it. And when you do that, in 1957, no African-Americans got elected. 1959, no African-Americans got elected. 1961, the black population had grown to almost 1/4 of the community. And still, no African Americans were able to be elected. Oh, yeah, voter turnout. Another consequence of proportional representation is, again, I apologize for the R chart, you tend to have higher voter turnouts. And there's a couple of reasons for that. You'll notice here that the countries that have proportional systems have turnouts in, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, whereas countries that don't have proportional representation use district, you know, drop down 70s, 60s, 50s. United States, we're below 50% most of the time. And that's because, say you live in a single-member district, and it's been gerrymandered to elect somebody from the opposite party of what you are. Say you're a Democrat living in a safe Republican district, or a Green living in a safe Republican district, or a Libertarian living in a safe Democratic district. There's not much motivation for you to go out and vote because the candidate you want to win isn't going to win. The candidate you like isn't going to win. So you don't have much motivation to go to vote. And let's say you are actually the person for whom the district was designed. You're a Democrat in a safe Democrat district, or a Republican in a safe Republican district, and you want to go and show your support for your candidate. But if your daughter gets sick, if you get a flat tire, if it's raining, something comes up, well, they're going to win without your vote anyway. So you don't feel that motivated. And there's actually a direct correlation between how competitive the race is and how high the turnout is. Well, under a proportional system, more people are likely to elect somebody that represents them. And the more of your group that turns out, the more representatives you're going to be able to elect. So if the threshold of election is 10% or 15%, you're motivated to, well, if we get 30% out, you know, we're going to get three people. And if we get 40%, we're going to get four people. So by making the threshold of election smaller, which is what proportional representation does, you're more motivated to turn out the vote and elect somebody. Any questions so far? Sir? Okay, that's a good setup, because I'm now going to describe how it works. There's three basic systems of proportional representation. The simplest one is where you just vote for a party. By the way, the question was, how does this work? How do you vote in a proportional system? So let's say we have a 100-seat legislature, and we're going to divide the country up into 10 regions, where each region elects 10 people. And each political party puts up a slate of 10 candidates in whatever method the party uses to select their slate. Maybe they use a convention, maybe they use a primary. It doesn't matter. It's up to each party to put up their slate. On election day, you go to the polls, and this is what they did in South Africa. South Africa is very interesting because when they abolished apartheid, Nelson Mandela realized if they continued with the first-past-the-post single-member district system that existed under apartheid, that the the black majority would end up electing almost all the seats. The white minority would be underrepresented. And a couple of things happen when you are underrepresented. You either get apathetic or you get angry. And if you get angry and you have access to weapons, you have civil war. Well, he didn't want the ground set for civil war. So he said, we're going to have a proportional representation system. And the white minority agreed. Yes, that's the best thing to do. So this is what the ballot looked like in South Africa. They have the names of the parties. They have the party symbol, the party abbreviation, and then the photograph of the party leader. So this helps with all sorts of literacy issues. And you get to vote for, where's the African National Congress? Here we go. Here's Nelson Mandela's party. You get to vote for the party you like. And if the party you like gets 40% of the vote in that 10-member district, they get 40% of the seats. They get four of those 10 seats. Each party, when they prepared their list, they prepared the list in order. They numbered their people 1 to 10. So the top four people from that list, in this case, would be elected. That's called a closed list system. There's also, what did I do with, oh, here it is. There's also an open list system. which is what they use in Denmark, where they don't put just the party names on the ballot, they also put the people who are in the list on the ballot. You know, the party says, this is our slate of candidates, but there's no order to it. I get to vote not just for the party that I want, but for the person in that party. So I'm going to vote, just to be different, for the Conservative Party, and I'm going to vote for Bent Hove. Well, if the Conservative Party gets total, you total up all the votes by party, and if the Conservative Party gets 30% of the vote, they're entitled to three of those 10 seats. And their top vote getter gets the first seat, their second vote getter gets the second, and so on. So the voters get to decide the order of the list for the party that they like. This is called an open list system. This is the system used in Germany and New Zealand and a few other places. It's called the mixed member proportional system. It's a little bit more sophisticated than the party list system. We're going to take that 100-member legislature, or the region of 10, and we're going to divide that region of 10 into five single-member districts. So each district elects one person, plus we have five seats left over. We're going to assign those five seats in a proportionate fashion to how people vote. Everybody gets two ballots. So in my district, let's say I'm a member of the Progressive Green Party, so I'm going to vote for the Progressive Greens. But they don't have a candidate in my district, and Cheryl Cadman is my next-door neighbor. I really like her. So I'm going to vote for her to represent me. So whoever wins, this is a first-past-the-post in the district election, whoever wins in that district gets that seat. But then we have to figure out how do we assign the remaining five. Well, let's say the Green Party on this side of the ballot gets 30% of the vote. So they're entitled to three of those 10 seats. If the Green Party elects one person from a district, well, that's one of the three, they then get two more from the at-large seats. If the New Zealand National Party, say they also get 30% of the vote in this region, if they elected two people from districts, well, that's two, then they get one additional seat to make up the difference. So the proportional seats are assigned in a compensatory fashion so that the overall result is proportional. Some people say, well, why don't we just treat this as two totally separate elections and assign the five seats in proportion to this vote and let these districts fall as they may. But then you don't get an overall proportional result. Any questions so far? Now, these two systems, the party list system and the mixed member proportional, you notice we talk about political parties. Those two systems only work when you have political parties. Well, in California, in our municipal elections, I don't know what it's like in Oregon, we have nonpartisan elections for city councils. And there is a form of proportional representation that works with both parties and nonpartisan. And that's called choice voting. It has a bunch of names, preference voting, single transferable vote. It's very similar to instant runoff voting in that the way it works is you rank the candidates. And this is how they used to vote in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when they used hand-counted paper ballots. You rank the candidates. And I'm going to explain this twice. That's one form of ballot. And then this, again, is the optical scan ballot that they use in Cambridge, which is a lot easier to count. Anyway, the machines can count that. And then you can verify by counting it by hand that it works. The way this works is, say we're electing nine seats. I'm going to change the number for a minute. Well, if you're electing one person, you don't require that one person to get all the vote. You only require that one person to get slightly more than half the vote. So, by extension, if you're electing two people, you don't require that each of those two winners get half the vote. You only require that they each get slightly more than a third of the vote. Because if two people each get slightly more than a third of the vote, then there's less than a third left over, you couldn't elect a third person. If you're electing three people, the threshold is 25% plus one. If you're you're electing 9 people, the threshold is 1 over 1, 9 plus 1 is 10, so 1/10 of the vote plus 1. So let's say we have 10,000 voters, and we're electing 9 people to the city council. The threshold is going to be 1/10 of 10,000 is 1,000. We add 1. That makes this threshold of election 1,001. So let's say Mary gets 4,004 votes. She clearly wins. She got above this threshold of 1,001. But she got 4 times as many votes as she needed. So, and can we warm up the projector because we're going to go into that in a minute? If we just set aside all 4,004 votes that elected her, well, 3,003 of those votes were wasted because they could have been used to elect somebody else. So what we're going to do is we're going to let Mary keep 1,001 of her first choice votes, and we're going to take 3,003 of those votes and assign them to the second choice on each of those ballots. So those people won't have wasted their votes. And let's say those 3,003 transfer in a block to Fred. And say Fred didn't have any first choice votes of his own. Now Fred's got 3,003 votes. He's got 3 times as many votes as he needs to be elected. So he keeps 1,001, and the other 2,002 get transferred now to their third choice, and so on down the line, until you've transferred all the excess votes from all the winners. And this block of voters of 4,004 would end up filling electing 4 of those 9 seats. Well, now we have people who, we still have seats left over, no one is over the threshold. We now do what we do in instant runoff voting, where we eliminate the person on the bottom and transfer those votes. And I know that most of you got lost here, so we're going to go to a video clip that will explain this in more detail. Yeah, fill that light. Oh, mic by the speaker.
When we elect several winners to a city council, it's a bit different, but the principles are the same. This is how preference voting will work for electing a city council like the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Candidates run citywide. Voters rank the candidates as in the previous example, 1, 2, 3, and so on. To win a seat, a candidate doesn't need a majority of votes. Instead, each winner must reach the winning threshold, that is, the fewest number of voters that can support only the winning number of candidates. If there are 15 voters and 3 seats up for election, for example, a winner needs the support of 4 voters. Only 3 candidates can possibly get 4 votes each. That's why it takes 4 votes to win a seat. These 4 voters are the constituency that can hold their representative accountable. In this example, there are 6 candidates. 3 are liberal, 3 are more conservative. We start by counting voters' first choices. Candidate A is the winner because she has 8 votes. That's 4 votes more than the winning threshold. No one else is an immediate winner. Here's how we figure out who wins the rest of the seats. The fairest way is to look first at the ballots of Candidate A. Candidate A is so popular that she has far more votes than she needs, a majority of the votes cast, in fact. Instead of these votes being wasted, and instead of a majority of voters only electing 1 candidate, these votes can now be transferred to the second choice candidates, as indicated on voters' ballots. Candidate A has received twice as many votes as she needs. That means only half of each vote is needed to elect her. The other half of these votes can be given to the next choice candidate as indicated on each ballot. This way, candidate A's supporters can elect a second candidate. In a real election in San Francisco, of course there will be more candidates and thousands of voters, and a simple computer program will be used to ensure a fast and accurate counting of ballots. Now we see that most supporters of Candidate A list one of Candidate A's fellow liberals, Candidates B and C, as a second choice. But after transferring all of Candidate A's surplus votes, Candidate A still remains the only candidate to reach the winning threshold. Not everyone can win, of course. And now it is necessary to eliminate the candidate with the fewest votes. In this case, the last place candidate is candidate F. She has half a vote because she was the second choice of one of candidate A's supporters. Candidate F loses, but her half vote is not wasted. Instead, it is transferred at its same value to candidate C. Candidate C is the third choice on that voter's ballot. Now candidate E, another conservative candidate, is in last place and is eliminated. But the votes of the people who supported him are not wasted. They go at their same value to the next choice indicated on the ballots. Candidate B, the final conservative candidate, receives all of these transfer votes and wins by surpassing the four-vote threshold. Candidate D has one surplus vote, so votes of candidate D's supporters are transferred at a much reduced value to the next choice on each ballot. These voters have an opportunity to elect another candidate. Candidate C receives enough of these transfer votes to win the third and final seat. Note that candidates B and C each started off with one first-place vote. But candidate C has won because she gathered more transfer ballots when other candidates won or were defeated. She clearly has reached out more effectively to the supporters of other candidates, which shows why preference voting promotes coalition building. The overall results are very fair. Nearly every voter, 14 out of 15, elect someone. 12 of the 15 voters elect their first choice, a full 80%. Liberal candidates win two seats with 10 of the 15 first choice votes. Conservative candidates win one seat with 5 first choice votes. As many voters as possible win fair representation.
Any questions so far? All right. Well, yes. That's a very good question. Where can you go for more information? I want to give you a couple of websites. Where's my blanks? Okay. First off, my organization, even though most of you aren't in California, Californians for Electoral Reform, CFER.org. But then there's Fair Vote, the Center for Voting and Democracy, FAIRVOTE.org. They're a nationwide organization, and they promote instant runoff voting, proportional representation, redistricting reform. They're an excellent organization. So if you start with either one of those sites, you can't go wrong. I do want, in the time remaining, to talk about, well, how do we change the system in this country to use proportional representation? And our strategy in California is to start off with instant runoff voting because that's a lot easier for people to understand. We have a lot of two-round runoff elections for mayors and city councils, single-member district city councils. And it's a real simple sell to switch from two-round runoff to instant runoff because you're eliminating a second election. You're making it cheaper for the community, cheaper for the jurisdiction. The government doesn't have to spend money on a second election. You're making it cheaper for the candidates because they don't have to raise money. One of the things we found, if I'm running in an instant runoff election, I don't want to throw mud against my opponents because I might need to be listed as second choice by my opponent's supporters in order to win. We saw this happen in San Francisco. So people will conduct more positive campaigns. We even saw candidates campaigning cooperatively. There was an Asian American, an Irish American, an Italian American in a particular district who held joint fundraisers and joint campaign appearances. Basically, you know, each was able to reach out to their communities and say, well, rank me number one and then my two colleagues as two and three. None of them actually won, so it didn't help them in that effect, but we saw the effects of encouraging positive campaigns. So the strategy for this decade is to get people to use instant runoff voting. Once people are used to ranking candidates, then in the next decade, we can start switching some of those elections, like San Jose, is going to be faced with a redistricting issue. San Francisco is going to be faced with a redistricting issue in 2010. Well, people are ranking candidates. Why don't they just rank the candidates citywide? And then you have proportional representation. We might also have momentum built for using instant runoff voting in the next decade to elect maybe members of the state assembly or the governor's race or some of the statewide races. So this decade, the decade of the aughts, is the decade of local instant runoff voting. The decade of the teens is the decade of local proportional representation and instant runoff voting on the statewide basis. Then the decade of the 20s, once people get used to electing people using proportional representation in their city councils, and those people run for higher office, that's another part of the strategy, politicians are afraid of something that they haven't experienced. But the politicians today getting elected in San Francisco using instant runoff voting, when they get elected to the state assembly, you know, 6, 8, 10 years from now, they're not going to be afraid of it. We have a bill right now in the state legislature that's dying that would allow communities to use instant runoff voting. General law cities, only charter cities right now can do it. And it's dying for lack of support. But once we get more legislators who are used to it, because they've used it in their charter cities, they'll say, sure, there's no problem with this. So the decade of the 20s would be the decade of proportional representation at the statewide level. And this is one possibility. And maybe instant runoff voting for president. And the decade of the 30s would be when we get the federal law changed so that we can finally elect Congress using proportional representation. So the key to getting this is to start local. And my time is up. And I'll be happy to stick around after the next speaker. I know people are going to want to go to dinner, but I can stick around for a few minutes to take some more questions if there are any at that point. Thank you very much.
I've been listening to Steve Chesson. This is the National Summit to Save Our Elections coming from Portland, Oregon, from the First Unitarian Church. He's going to answer some questions.
This thing, California elects its state assembly using 80 single-member districts. And what this shows is grouping those five of those single-member districts. You take five of those districts and make one large super district, so there's now 16 super districts throughout the state. And an analysis of voting patterns shows that each one of these districts will elect both Republicans and Democrats. The liberal areas will elect 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. Super liberal areas like San Francisco will elect 4 Democrats and 1 Republican. The conservative areas of the state will elect 3 Republicans and 2 Democrats, studying existing voting patterns. That's not to say voting patterns might not change, and you might see Greens and Libertarians also getting elected. But what this means is that there's no orphan Democrats, no orphan Republicans, any place in the state, as there is today, where Democrats are only represented in the urban areas and Republicans are only represented in the rural areas today. This provides two-party representation throughout the whole state with an opportunity for third-party representation as well. So this is what we're hoping to eventually have in California. You can do something similar in Oregon. Yes. Well, there's 5 districts. There'd be 5 representatives for each. I'm sorry, the question is, with these districts so large geographically, how are you going to get much face-to-face contact between the representative and their constituents? Well, the first thing is that there are 5 representatives in each of those districts. So they get to choose, you know, who they want to see, or people get to choose which representative they want to go to. It does make it difficult. We do have to rely on telephone and travel. One possibility, of course, is increasing the size of the legislature. Right now, we have 1 representative for every 300,000 people in California, 1 state assembly person. Every 300,000, you know, that I don't know what it is in Oregon, what your ratio is, but that's tremendous. Okay, so we really have that problem today. It doesn't really make it much worse because you still have the same ratio. It'd still be a 300,000-to-1 ratio if you don't change the size of the assembly. Any other questions? Where's the next speaker?
What was the key to the successful IRV campaign in San Francisco?
Well, a lot of grassroots work. It was put on the ballot by the Board of Supervisors. It always works best to do these things with either a charter review committee or some kind of citizens-appointed task force, as opposed to doing it by petition. And that's about all I can say right now, because I don't want to take any time away from the next speaker. But feel free to talk to me more about that afterwards.
And our next speaker here is Colin Jacobson, and I don't know if you're going to have another speaker, but I'll let her introduce herself. Again, we're going to try to keep this on schedule here. So, go ahead, Colin.
Well, okay, the dinner is a... I have some handouts to give the people that are in the box. I gave them this. Someone took them when I came in. Yeah. Hi, everybody. I'm really, really happy to be here. Because it took me about 4.5 hours to get here from Seattle today. Really bad rain, and I'm just very happy to be here alive. So my name is Holly Jacobson, and I'm going to talk to you about what we've been doing in New Mexico. First, I want to take a show of hands and see who knows. Raise your hand if you know anything about the lawsuit that's going on in New Mexico right now regarding electronic voting machines. I'm sorry. Can you hear me now? It's just this reverberation. So no one in the audience knows anything about what we're doing in New Mexico or the lawsuit that's going on there right now. Great. Okay. When did you find out about it? Well, I'm going to give you a real... We don't have very much time, and I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from what we're doing there and what's happening. And the lawsuit's currently in the discovery phase right now. And so I want to share those findings with you, too. Can I have that back here? I can't reach that. So, history of how this lawsuit... So first of all, to back up, a lawsuit was filed in January 14th of this past year to place a permanent injunction against the machines that caused so many problems. And we started... I'm just going to give you a little brief history about this effort. The decision was made to go into New Mexico for a recount last November around Thanksgiving time, when a bunch of people who've been speaking here today and around the country who were concerned about this issue and concerned about electronic voting issues and privatization issues of our elections kind of looked at where we might be able to support other efforts other than Ohio. And the decision was made to go into New Mexico because of a few factors. One was, some believed it was really important to show that there were electronic voting problems and problems with privatized elections, not just in Ohio, which was fairly politically charged and brought a lot of political baggage to it. And so we wanted to illustrate that there were actual problems elsewhere. We knew about the problems in New Mexico prior to Election Day, even prior to early voting, based on accounts that we'd read in the media and some tests that had shown some pre-election tests that had shown really poor results. And so the decision was made to go into New Mexico, which also looked like a great laboratory, because in New Mexico they have a wide variety of machine types that they use and that are used all over the country. And so detailed comparative analysis could be done. It was a small margin of victory, less than 1%, so we felt like there was a good chance we could overturn it based on all the trouble reports we saw from early voting and things that just didn't look right. So we filed for a recount, actually, on behalf of David Cobb, if he's here. He's here somewhere. And Michael Bednarik stepped up to the plate to file for a recount. when no one else would, and we were blocked, essentially. We were blocked by the canvassing board there. And another reason we chose to go to New Mexico is because the recount laws were so clear. That it was not a discretionary choice by the canvassing board, but they blocked us anyway. And so while this was going through the courts, a lot of detailed analysis was being conducted by a wonderful woman named Ellen Tyson and a wonderful man named Warren Stewart. And they were looking at just the official results from the election and saw a lot of problems. And what they were able to do is pinpoint specific problems to specific machine types and compare data from precinct to precinct. And they saw that on one machine type, on one paperless electronic voting machine type, there were 24,000 undervotes. An undervote, if you guys don't know, is when a ballot is cast but no vote recorded. Now, typically in an election, there'll be a few undervotes, less for president, but these are 24,000 presidential undervotes in a race where less than 1% of the the margin of victory is less than 1%. So they saw thousands of phantom votes that they could trace to specific machine types. And the other thing that was really disturbing about this, which is very common across the country, is that these undervotes were traced to Native American and Hispanic precincts. So precincts that had a Native American and Hispanic plurality had very high undervote rates, sometimes up to 40% and beyond. That means that the people in those precincts, you know, 30, 40% of them, but consistently 20%, just a very high number, went to go, they cast a ballot, but there was no vote recorded for president. And so when we went through, we kind of exhausted all the legal possibilities for the recount and were shut down with that effort. And the Secretary of State was threatening to clear the machines. We filed this lawsuit that is active right now. And the lawsuit was filed on behalf of 8 New Mexico voters, called the Voters Lawsuit. And like I said earlier, it's to block the machines that we know have been tied to so many problems. And so now we're in discovery of this lawsuit. And if we can continue to raise the money, I was going to talk to you about statistics of what happened in New Mexico, but I've got them in some handouts, and people are probably throwing a lot of statistics out. What's that?
The timeline that they took for machine
tally data. No, you don't have the handouts yet. I just got here. I just drove in. So, but I want to tell you where we're at right now because we have such limited time, then open it up for questions. And then you can see all the horrifying statistics. I mean, you guys are here because you know something's wrong. And you should look at the analysis because it does, there's a lot there. But currently, what we've found so far in the discovery phase of the lawsuit, that's where we're taking depositions and of different people at the Secretary of State's office who are in charge of voting machines, who are in charge of the official canvas, and then also the vendor who sells the machines and services the machines and does a lot of the ballot programming for 30 of the 33 counties. We discovered that, I'll just read this update I created earlier this week. It says, our initial discovery process is revealing startling evidence of serious voting machine problems, top to bottom incompetence of the administration of elections, cover up by election officials of major errors they know have gone uncorrected, and the ceding by election officials of oversight and control of our elections to unaccountable private companies. Examples of this evidence gleaned from 2 weeks of depositions include: a voting machine vendor has admitted under oath the design of the machines used by many New Mexico counties probably causes the unintended erasure of presidential votes contrary to the voter's intent. So we had the guy who sells the machines and does the ballot programming tell us why he thinks there were 24,000 undervotes. And he thinks it's a design flaw. But he says he's known this for years. He just never brought it to anyone's attention. The owner of the private New Mexico company that has been paid commissions by Sequoia Voting Systems on sales of their ABC Edge touchscreen voting system to New Mexico counties testified that the system lost votes in a Bernalillo County election and that he is suspicious of Sequoia's claims that all of the lost data was successfully recreated. So thousands of votes were lost in Bernalillo County, and Sequoia took the cartridge up to Denver, where they're based. They have a main office, and recreated the election. And the CEO of the company that has the Sequoia gig in New Mexico says he has no faith that that election, those results, I mean, obviously. So the state and county post-election canvas processes are incapable of detecting most types of voting machine error or fraud. This was one thing that was not the primary focus of our lawsuit, but we're realizing also needs to be considered when we're looking at fair and transparent elections, and that's the canvassing of elections. We took the deposition of a third-party vendor who created an electronic, privatized electronic canvas tool online that was the shoddiest thing I've ever seen, that they had no testing procedures for. And it illustrates why privatization of elections is so problematic, because no one's responsible. Contracting out key parts of the canvas process to unaccountable private contractors and subcontractors has increased vote counting errors and heightened security risks. A closer look at the independent audit of the 2004 general election touted by the Secretary of State reveals that it consistently underreports as single errors, common mistakes, and irregularities, even when the error results in the miscounting of hundreds of votes. What we saw from the auditor was that the state contracted was, they'll say, one voting error on a trouble log, and then they'll say 165 votes. So it means one voting error type, but no one's counted up the total of those votes. I've got some volunteers who are working on that right now. But they said there are 539 voting errors, but that could include, like I said, a number of votes that are undisclosed at this time. So, and also they, you know, when they found so many errors, they didn't follow up with the rest. They did a 10% or 20% audit of the precincts. This is just reconciling the poll tapes with this audit tool, just making sure everything looks okay. They found 539 voting errors. They didn't look at the other 80 to 90% of the votes in this state. Again, this is a state with a very small margin of victory in the presidential race, with a lot at stake, a Democratic governor and a Democratic Secretary of State. So this is definitely a nonpartisan issue of democracy. And our next step is to do a thorough examination of several types of voting machines. Through some wonderful volunteers throughout New Mexico, we've been able to establish some relationships with key county clerks who've reserved some voting machines for us to access. They've been holding on to these since the November election. And we're hoping to bring in our, you know, academic and credentialed experts to look at these machines and try and do our own recreation of what happened to some of the votes. High number of switch votes with touchscreen voting machines also that needs to be mentioned, because that's very difficult to trace. And it doesn't show up as an undervote, and it doesn't show up as a phantom vote, but a switched vote is very problematic. So if we can raise adequate funding, we'll get to look at these machines. And that's where we're at right now, and I'm happy to take any questions. Yes. A switch vote? I'm sorry, thanks. A switch vote is you push on Kerry and get Bush. Or you push on in New Mexico, there was a race between a Democratic congressperson and Republican congressperson, Upstart, and a lot of switch votes in New Mexico in that race that I want to investigate further. Pardon me? Well, you know, We don't know for sure unless we can go look at the actual data. But we have the Albuquerque president of the Albuquerque City Council, Eric Riego, who's running for mayor of Albuquerque, extremely credentialed and respected attorney. One of our plaintiffs works in the Albuquerque court system. These are not hysterical people. This happened to them. So there were a high number of incident reports. And that's one of the things that brought us to New Mexico, is we saw a lot of... Greg Pallas did an article on this vote-switching issue in early voting. What I'm saying is not even that. What I'm saying is on the screen, in New Mexico, they have touchscreen voting machines without paper ballots. And on the screen, they pushed on Kerry and Bush lit up. I want to talk to you just briefly about voter-verifiable paper ballots with touchscreen voting machines, because I have some strong opinions and I've got this microphone right now. And that's that I think they're a bad idea, because I think they give people a false sense of security. Thanks. And I'm going to give you an example of why. You can go to Voters Unite and read three stories on this issue. And I can't remember the county in California, but they did a test of that Sequoia was showing off their voting machinery with a voter verifiable paper ballot printer intact in California to a bunch of officials. And they were, you know, demonstrating how when you vote it prints up the voter verifiable paper ballot. And then they went to also demonstrate how you could vote in Spanish and how it was very, you know, Spanish language friendly. And so a staffer had the presence of mind to say, okay, well, what is the internal tape? Because they voted in Spanish several times, and the voter verifiable paper ballot said, read, that the votes were cast as intended. So that gave them a sense of security. But a staffer said, well, look at the internal machine tape and let's see what that says. And it said zero, because this Sequoia machine, which was also used in New Mexico, did not record votes when they were cast in Spanish. But the voter verifiable paper ballot said that it did. So the other thing is that since I've got the podium on this issue, paper ballots are very hard to recount if they're on thermal paper, like flim, you know. Anyway, I'm going to stop on that. You had a question.
Aren't you going to encounter difficulty examining the software code for the company's claim proprietary secret?
I don't know how far we're going to get. I don't know how far we're going to get with software code. And there's some question about, for example, the local vendor in New Mexico does all the ballot programming for all their, you know, for op scans and some of the full face DREs. So.
You say if you were blocked, what does that mean, you were blocked?
That means we were shut down. The Governor Bill Richardson, Secretary of State Rebecca Villarón, and the other member of the canvassing board.
Shut down.
I mean that we paid the deposit and submitted the required documents that are spelled out in New Mexico law, and they said they would not allow the recount to go unless we paid $1.4 million, which was 10 times the amount, within 36 hours. Next.
Yeah, that was a stunning event, the Richardson committee or group. And my question is, two questions, why would they pick such an insane figure? Even Ohio doesn't do that. Secondly, what's his motivation for doing that? Is he taking marching orders from the DNC?
Yeah, I get this question a lot, and I can't answer it. Okay. Sorry, I can't answer it. I mean, I'm not suppressing information. Can't answer it. It's just all speculation.
So what strategy are you proposing here that we can use another
state? Great question. So the question was, what's the strategy that we're proposing to be used in other states for other elections? And the thing I like about this that we're doing in New Mexico is it's not really about the 04 election. It's about protecting future elections, which is why we're all spending time here today. But what we're doing in New Mexico, we've decided, these, I'm sitting in these depositions and I'm watching the, you asked how are we going to get access to, it's amazing what happens when you turn the heat up. David Cobb has this great, he's not here, but he has this great Texas colloquialism about politicians and turning the heat up and they make really good decisions. But so we're working with election reform folks in New Mexico who are, and then we're working on this lawsuit. And I think it's a great model because we're kind of working both angles. And we're the same group of people essentially working both angles. We meet, we're the same core group of folks. And one of the things that we would like to do is set up a legal resource service bureau for other organizations, grassroots, and citizens groups across the country so that when they have, so that they can do this in their states. And you always have to make decisions. You know, the great thing is that the courts are still a great tool for our democracy. The problem with that is it's costly, and the laws are very different in every state. So that's our kind of long-term goal, is to set up a legal resource center and research center for this work. No, he's had his hand up for a while. I'm sorry. Okay. The cost of the lawsuit is $250,000. We've raised $50,000. We need money. We need two things, money and money, right now, because we have this opportunity that I don't believe exists elsewhere right now, and we have a very short time frame in which to access it. Regarding the question about how many counties do their own ballot programming, it varies because they use OpScans, touchscreens, and full-face DREs, so to explain that would probably take too long, but it varies from county to county which ballot programming they do for which machines. Sequoia does all the ballot programming for touchscreens. Period. End of story. You had a question? So, yeah. Well, I know at least in New Mexico, and then they also use ESNS machines in New Mexico. Go ahead. All right. We started an organization to push this lawsuit forward, and it's called Voter Action, www.voteraction.org, and I've got three bumper stickers. They're really cute. I'll show you in just a little bit. Is that your question, or did you have a follow-up? So you're going to have to speak up. Mm-hmm. The point of the complaint is to obtain a permanent injunction against the voting machines that cause so many problems. Exactly. That's right. But see, it has national implications because these machines are used everywhere. Again, it's the machines used in New Mexico in the 04 election that we know caused the problems. Go ahead. Speak up.
You said there were deficiencies in the procedures on how to detect errors in the software. Is that for procedures before the election, or ones after, or both?
Oh, man. Well, I don't have enough time to answer that question. I wish I did, but I'm happy to talk to you about it afterwards. The question was, there's deficiencies in the testing? Oh, yeah. In the Canvas process. All of the above. Okay, I have 1 minute. Anyone? Oh, wait. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Yes. Are you working with any national organizations that help you deal with the lawsuit? And I'm thinking also of how we from other states can benefit from your experience.
Well, yeah, I think that there is a lot of benefit. I mean, I live in Seattle, And I'm traveling down to New Mexico because I think this does have national significance. We do need to share our findings. And, you know, as we go along, all of us kind of work pioneering this work need to keep records and figure out what works and what doesn't. We've had a lot of success in I think, just trying different strategies out in New Mexico, and we need to share that information. And that's what we're hoping to do with the long-term goals of voter action. Well, yeah, that's another, I think that's another conference. Thanks, you guys. Oh, and if you want a bumper sticker, I'm going to give them out, and I'll have them up front. And if you want to donate money or know someone who might, that'll be up front, too.
You can just stay here.
We were just listening to Holly Jacobson talking about the events in New Mexico, the fact that there's a lawsuit going there. And I didn't get an answer to my question. You're listening to the... I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I have handouts. And since there's no thing coming... Here.
What we are doing here is we're at the National Summit to Save Our Elections, and we're coming to you from the First Unitarian Church in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you.
And we've just been listening to Holly Jacobson, who managed to get here in time. It's raining all the way from Seattle down to here, and it's about a normally about a four-hour drive from Seattle to Portland, and it was great. She came rushing in, and just in time to get her little half hour. she lives in Seattle, but obviously they're working on this lawsuit in New Mexico, and I guess part of the significance there is that that was just a 1% majority giving the state. I assume the 1% is talking about the presidential election. I think New Mexico has four or five electoral votes, and I can't remember whether it was critical or not. Maybe somebody else knows that. What we're going to do now is take an hour and a half break. We're going to take a break for dinner. What we're going to do is... I'm trying to think what I want to do. We might play what we've already been listening to from this morning until now, hearing David Cobb and Dan Meek and Steve Chesson's difficult to understand report. Unfortunately, he was using a lot of graphics on the screen, so he's talking about O's and X's and things there. And it's difficult, to present that on the radio or the internet radio. What's going to happen tonight at 6:30 Pacific, which is 9:30 Eastern? I bet you already knew that. Darlene Hooley, who is the congresswoman from the 5th District of Oregon, and I'm guessing that may have something to do with Portland. She's going to be talking about welcoming us. Then we're going to listen to two panel discussions. One of them will be moderated by Brad Friedman. And the panelists are Paul Leto, Ellen Thiessen, and Clint Curtis, and Pokey Anderson, who is here with me, can tell you who Paul Leto, Ellen Thiessen, and Clint Curtis are. I'm just talking about what we're going to be doing tonight at 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific, and those in the middle can figure out the times themselves.
Okay, you want me to give you a little rundown?
Yeah, what's wrong with electronic elections and what can we do about it?
Yeah, well, that's kind of more like a plenary, let's really all start off on the same place, even though we'll have been talking with each other for several hours. Paul Leto is based in Washington State. He's an attorney, and he's got some really interesting theories about how to go about legal action in this whole arena. He's a really bright guy. I think I think he's going to have some good stuff to say. Let's see.
Ellen Tyson.
Ellen Tyson is how she says her name. Ellen is also based in Washington State. She is, in some ways, the den mother of this movement. She has, she's the co-founder of VotersUnite.org, which has an enormous library of newspaper articles and other articles on elections and the things that get fouled up. She's got 22 years in the technical writing business. She understands software development, and she brings that knowledge and to this issue. And has basically come to the conclusion that computers and elections just don't mix.
Hmm.
And who's the third person? Brad.
Clint Curtis.
Clint Curtis. He had was doing software development and was approached by some folks, apparently including Tom Feeney, who is now in Congress, and was asked to develop something in software that would be able to rig an election. He was under the impression at the time that it was where you're trying to create something so then you can prevent it. And he's not sure it was ever used, but he has become a whistleblower. He's testified, I believe, in front of Congress or in front of one of those rump committees that people like John Conyers have set up when they're not allowed to have an official hearing because the Republican majority of
the
whatever
basement
committee,
hearings.
Right, the basement hearings, second-class citizenship for the second-class minority.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Clint Curtis has testified that this is what he was asked to do. The story gets long and involved with a company called Yang Enterprises and so on. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see what he has to say. There's been a string of whistleblowers in this arena. There's a fellow in Georgia who was a subcontractor. He was supposed to go into a warehouse and deal with Diebold equipment, and he said, oh, yeah, they would tell us to put this patch on and then that patch, and then before we had tested any of those, then we would take those off and put another one on. And we kept saying, half of them have this patch and half have that. And, you know, there was just an incredible amount of chaos at the last minute before the election that he testified to. And then there's been a whistleblower in California who said similar things about how they were telling that their supervisors, look, the batteries aren't going to survive on these machines. This was, again, Diebold. And indeed, the batteries failed in the election to the point where, in I believe it was San Diego, something like 20%, 30% of the machines or the polls didn't open on time, and people were told, come back in 4 hours. I mean, it was a meltdown. And Diebold had been warned by this guy and the people he worked with. They testified in front of a California panel that advises the Secretary of State there, who used to be Kevin Shelley. Anyway, there's been a lot of whistleblowing going on, and I don't think it's reached critical mass yet, but certainly there are a number of people who have been talking. There's the most recent one has been talking to Brad Friedman, and we don't know that person's name yet, but that person supposedly
Deep Throat.
That person has been saying that he or she was pretty high up, knew some stuff that was going on, and that Diebold knew that their equipment, their voting tabulating equipment, had a backdoor in it, and didn't try to stop that. That's what I hear.
I'm curious about the batteries that failed. Was that like across all precincts, or was it only in certain places?
That I don't know. I know that San Diego is. I'm doing this by memory. I'm pretty sure it was San Diego was really seriously affected by it. I mean, people were just in an uproar. you know, I mean, most people go to the polls. They have one time slot they can do that. They can't just keep coming back. So.
Well, the thing about this, and I asked her about the certification, you know, is when, as I have told you, you know, probably numerous times, I was under contract at one point to write a voting system. This was about, I don't know, 96 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And this was a project that took about a year. We actually went for certification. We actually had to get the law changed. The legislature had to, because there was no provision for computer voting. So I probably am one of the people that created this debacle, although apparently in Texas it didn't really matter. And the certification process was very intense. There were requirements for audit trails, and that the ballots had to be done that they had to be stored in a certain way, and all this other stuff. And what I'm hearing now is this totally chaotic kind of behavior of all these people, and there doesn't seem to be any oversight on the part of the secretaries of state or, you know, whatever entities the states have for controlling the voting. I mean...
Well, they're controlling the voting, I believe.
Well, obviously they're controlling the voting. We certainly know that about Ohio New Mexico now from what Holly Jacobson said. But do you know anything about that, about this certification? And
the certification is about as sturdy as tissue paper.
Okay, so it matches what we got.
Yeah, definitely goes with it. It's a pair. The certification is quite murky. The certifying agencies on the national level, there's two or three. CyberTest. I don't have them in front of me, but.
In Texas, it was the Department of State.
Well, okay, so
and they had representatives from the Attorney General, and they had hackers. You know, people mm-hmm. who really knew computers and.
Right.
You know,
here's the deal. So you have these layers of authentication and certification, and some states say if you just go through the federal, we'll say fine. Other states have their own state system. Mm-hmm. And then there's also this federal software and hardware testing. But I'm talking about the federal level. They call them ITAs, or independent testing authorities. And the problem with this, there's many problems, but for one thing, it's very murky. Who are these people? Who appointed them? Who checks their work? Who pays them? Well, it turns out, guess who pays them? The vendor.
I see.
So it's like if you were going to school and you were taking algebra, but you were also paying the algebra teacher. Guess, you know, your grade might be okay. Bev Harris told the story of, she's the author of Black Box Voting, and she'll be here later this weekend. She told the story of her and Andy Stevenson going to visit one of these certifiers and interviewing a man named Sean Southworth, I believe his name is, and he wouldn't give up his resume. He wouldn't say what his qualifications were. And then when they asked him, you know, well, what all do you test? And then there were huge arenas of things that he wasn't testing. And some of these standards were written in 1990, so they're completely out of date. It's just a real murky system at best. The other thing is, if you talk to a guy like David Dill from verifiedvoting.org or David Jefferson, who was on that California panel that advised the Secretary of State and is Lawrence Livermore Labs. He's like Mr. Computer. He said, you know, look, you got 100,000 lines of code, 1 million lines of code. How on earth can anybody check all these lines of code? You just can't do it. It's not realistic to think that you can. And then the kicker to me is you can test all this code. You can make sure all the hardware works. But on election day, how do you know what's actually in that computer that you're voting on right now? You don't. The testing that would be required is just stunning. Because you'd have to test each computer that was put in place to make sure that it exactly matched. And then you would also have to make sure some of these for instance, Diebold in Georgia, they use this smart card that you put in, that the voter puts in. What if the smart card has software on it that is just activated by this particular, order of strange votes or whatever?
You can do anything.
You can do
with
anything
computers.
With computers, just about.
We know that.
Except maybe have fair, honest, transparent elections.
Well, no, actually, I mean, you could have a computer that does a perfectly good job of voting, and it's fair and so forth, but that doesn't mean that you would.
Well,
I mean, it's all up to the humans, and the thing is, I guess the computer is really good at obscuring the facts. It's not as simple as a Shoup voting machine or, a paper ballot. It's very straightforward.
But as one of the people that testified in California said, look, if they have plenty of software out there, what if you got on a plane and they said, we decided the pilots really get paid too much. We're going to run this whole plane on automatic pilot. We're going to do it all electronically. It's pre-programmed, don't worry. And so you're going to fly.
There's a joke about that.
You're going to fly from L.A. to New York on this pre-programmed plane. Would you do it?
You have nothing to fear.
Yeah, right.
To fear.
Exactly.
To fear.
And so, but see, that's not a plane that, hopefully, that anybody is trying to crash for profit. The election system is something that is trying to be crashed for profit, trying to be corrupted for profit. And the profit involved is control of local, state, or national treasuries. Now, that is a very large pot. We're not just talking about stealing somebody's tennis shoes here. This is, as David Dulles put it, this is like one of the most, the best bunches of loot anywhere in the universe is, say, the Federal Treasury and the ability to funnel that to your buddies. So you don't just need the kind of protection that you would get, to make sure you put bars on top of the candy bar machine to make sure nobody turns it upside down and steals the money or the candy bars. We're talking major threat based on the amount of reward that's involved. And when you're talking about electronic theft, the risk is definitely lower because what kind of fingerprints are you leaving if you program this?
The risk to the people who were hacking.
Right, to the crooks.
Yeah.
If you program this thing 6 months in advance and then you leave the company, what's the odds you're going to get caught? We don't know.
I always like to say that we now have elections. You don't even need to bother to vote. Your vote will be cast for you. So what we kind of come back to is we've learned our lesson. It's paper ballots, and just take the time to count them and do the job.
It's not even a matter of time.
We don't really need efficiency in voting.
It's actually not even a matter of time, Otis. I think paper ballots can be counted in 2, 3, 4 hours, just like they do in Canada, where they have, big cities and everything. They count those ballots, and they're done in 2, 3, 4 hours. And, with electronic voting, you can't always say that.
Right.
They talk about speed, but speed is not the important thing.
Right.
And it's...
Accuracy.
Accuracy would be
like
accuracy,
see.
Honesty, transparency. Everybody, in every election, you're going to have at least one loser. And they say that the sign of a fair election is that not just the winner is happy, but the loser is happy that it was a fair election. And right now, no matter what you think about computers and elections or any of this, you would have to say that not everybody agrees that these elections are fair. There's a huge amount and growing of citizens that would say, we really have a doubt. And you can say, I've seen numbers 20%, 40%. So that's a pretty big bunch of unhappy people.
Destabilizing to a democracy.
Right.
You're listening to Pokey Anderson. I'm Otis McClay. We are talking to you from the sanctuary at the First Unitarian Church in Portland, Oregon, where we've been listening today to the National Summit to Save Our Elections, and brought by a coalition, all kinds of people. If you want to see that webpage, it's at the kpftx.org webpage. There's a link that shows you what's coming up next. Tonight, it says conference plenary opens, but I think we've been doing stuff before then. Right now it's dinner break, and Toki and I are going to go have dinner because we're not getting paid for this.
<It's>
which maybe makes it even better.
Well,
tonight is
our reward is that you all listeners out there tell some other people.
Yeah.
So please do.
Well, people know this is actually kind of interesting stuff. Tomorrow is also going to be interesting, and we'll talk about that later. That schedule is on the webpage, and if you're listening to us, you do have access to the Internet. Tonight we're going to hear Darlene Hooley welcome us, and then we have two panel discussions. What's wrong with electronic elections, and what can we do about it? Brad Friedman will be moderating with Paul Leto, Ellen Tyson, and Clint Curtis. And then Meet the Press, the media stumbling block. Ooh, talking about the media. Bypassing a complacent media to sound the alarms, the alarm on elections in crisis.
Not even just complacent.
Yeah, with Brad
Complicit,
Friedman.
Complicit, I would say, in some cases.
Good. Brad Friedman and Bob Kohler will be doing that. Bob Kohler is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune and the Tribune Syndicate. Who has, I think, an interesting story to tell, and Brad's had him on his show. Tomorrow night, we will be doing the Brad Show from 4 to 8 Pacific. That's 7 to 11 Eastern, and that will be on the regular Brad Show blog. We will be bringing you the proceedings tomorrow as well from here, from Portland, Oregon. We're going to adjourn now. Do you have any final things you'd like to say? I was going to say last words, but I don't think that...
Come back.
Really
listen to some more. We're just getting warmed up here.
Yeah, at 9:30 tonight, Eastern, 6:30 Pacific, we will be back. We'll be back a little bit before that, and we'll be listening to the evening plenary session. And so this is Otis McClay.
And Pokey Anderson.
And thanks for being there, and we will see you later.